finish our much more enjoyable in the spring and summer of the year. But it can be pretty nice this time of year, too, as long as we have things that can keep us warm during the course of our ongoing conversation. And, of course, Friday on the front porch is an opportunity sort of to clear the decks, as it were, of the stuff that has been in the stack for the better part of the week that we haven't gotten to. And there are, indeed, a bunch of those. We've got leftovers. Maybe it's leftover Friday when you get right down to it. We've got leftovers from Wednesday prayer meeting. And we've got leftovers from the other days as well when we just didn't get to stuff that needed getting to. So we're going to hit all of those if possible. And, yes, I did just I did just pop in midstream there. That's because I missed a button. But we're here, and it's live, and it's real. It really, really is real. So jump right in. It is Friday. Everything is, it's open season on anything that you want to bring to the table. I'll get us started. I'll get us started just by remembering somebody. A couple of days ago that I saw this posted to Nick Regalado's the Facebook page. You know Nick, the Coalfield Kingsnake. And I didn't want to let the weekend without noting the passing of this individual, because something goes along with him, or leaves this earth with him, and I'm talking about the passing of Tsutomu Yamaguchi, who was 93 years old when he passed away. At 93, he had finally succumbed to stomach cancer. And he occupied a rather special place on the planet. He was the only human being who was a recognized survivor of both the first use of a nuclear weapon against a civilian population, that being the atomic blast leveled the city of Hiroshima, and the second attack on a civilian population using an atomic weapon, that being the U.S. bombing that leveled Nagasaki. The first thing you can say is that's some horrible luck. The second thing you can say is that in a way it is a blessing to all of us that there was such an individual. It was a strange series of events somewhat that led to Mr. Yamaguchi's presence at both sites. He was a resident of Nagasaki, but he had gone to visit Hiroshima from Nagasaki, and he was in Hiroshima when the United States used an atomic device for the first time in the history of the Earth, and did so against a civilian population. He said that he, when the blast hit Hiroshima, he felt like a leaf on the wind and was picked up and carried on a cushion of air and rushing dust. He suffered serious burns, but as soon as he was able to travel, he returned home to Nagasaki. He was in the stairwell of an office building when that blast struck. If you want to hear more, I commend you to npr.org. and a blog called The Two Way. The headline is Japan's only known survivor of both atomic blasts has died. And he died from stomach cancer. And I don't wish to use, quote-unquote, Mr. Yamaguchi's passing as an extended metaphor for anything, but I suppose that's what I'm doing, and I apologize in advance. But this is a man who lived to be 93 years old after being caught up in two horrific attacks on civilian populations. Remember, the United States, the land of the free and the home of the brave, is the only country on earth ever to attack another country with atomic weapons. We just are. There's no hiding from it. I'm sure that if there were a bunch of little wing nuts out there, they'd be, yeah, but we did it for Jesus, or freedom, or we did it for democracy, or we done it for capitalism. Whatever reason you choose, you cannot evade the fact that the United States is the only country ever to drop two atomic weapons on two separate civilian population centers. Now, to be fair, the firebombing of both Dresden and Tokyo during the Second World War created massively more death. It was the atomic weapon itself, the fact that it could be done with one bomb, that was so potentially horrifying. But be that as it may, Mr. Yamaguchi at 93, who one might argue, depending on one's spiritual or faith stance, was kept alive on this planet and stayed alive on this planet as a living reminder for as long as possible of the fact that one ought not use atomic weapons on civilian populations. He died of stomach cancer. Now, he got doses of radiation in both blasts, but managed to stay alive. There is a photograph of him at the NPR website that I'm looking at right now from yesterday, January the 7th. And his is a kindly face. It is a face that has great life within it. But also at work, inside that body, at the time that photograph was taken, were the little horrors that take place on a subcellular level that lead to the greater horror that we call, generically, cancer. And you cannot argue that the radiation with which he was dosed twice had nothing to do with it. You simply can't argue that. You may most assuredly argue that the blasts did have something to do with it, and you can make a credible argument for that, but to argue that it didn't, no, that's not possible. And I say all this as a precursor to all of this godforsaken foolishness that is taking place with regard to these damnable body scanners that many are now calling for to be put in place at America's airports. And the people calling for the use of these things are doing so out of one of only two possible motives. The first motive is plain old bowel-watering, gut-bending terror and fear. Because the idea of something happening to a loved one, or to a family member, or a friend, or to an American or foreign national, to a human being, while in the course of an airline flight, holds an inexplicable horror that is almost primal in its ability to shape and change how we go about the business of traveling. There are people out there who have a profound phobia of flying at all. no matter how, you know, no matter, erase terrorism from the equation. And the idea of plummeting 40,000 feet to a grisly death speaks to them, and they therefore will not board an aircraft. Most aircraft mishaps occur on either takeoff or landing, and so you can take out the 40,000 feet, but it doesn't take the grisly death part out of the equation. For those people, flying is simply not an option. If I recall correctly, didn't sports commentator and former Oakland Raiders head coach, didn't he get to the point where he just took his personal bus from city to city for football games and so forth, or a train that would not get on an airplane? He's one of those people. So that's part of the calculus involved with flying. Now, factor into that calculus of potential disaster the possibility of an individual getting aboard an aircraft and deliberately destroying that aircraft and everyone on the aircraft itself, or in the aircraft itself, as George Carlin once noted. I'm not getting on the plane. I'm getting in the plane. Screw you. You get on the plane. We miss George Carlin. But you add in the terrorism aspect of it, and it becomes almost too much for some minds to contemplate, and being concerned as such, they are inclined to say, we will do anything that we must, anything that we may, anything that we can to prevent that from happening. And that is an entirely human response. Upon further reflection, it may not be rational, but it is most assuredly human. And so we get in the wake of the Undy bomber, which with every passing day becomes more and more suspect. Can you imagine you or I walking up to a plane counter for an international flight without a passport and having somebody come up and say, well, they're from Sudan, we do this all the time. Excuse me? Isn't there a terrorism issue with Sudan? Wasn't Al-Qaeda hanging out in Sudan for a while? Isn't that why we bombed a couple of installations there after the African embassy bombings back in the long-gone 1990s now, which for some reason or another don't seem so far away for me, but that's the nature of time. Hooty wheat, so it goes. Can you imagine doing that? And can you imagine anyone saying, well, okay, get on. Ah, you're in. Whatever. Poor little Sudanese fellow, you. There's all the red flags, you know, the guy's dad calls up and says, well, my son's been radicalized. You might want to keep him from flying anywhere. The whole scenario is just beginning to stink and stink and stink more. But anyway, with the Christmas Day incident in Detroit at hand, the security-minded, otherwise known as the terrified people, the people on whom terrorism has already worked. Note that, please. The people on whom terrorism has already worked. The people who are now terrified are demanding full-body scans. One of those people demanding full-body scans is, of course, Michael Chertoff. That creepy, skeletal, sort of hollow-eyed, dead-socketed monstrosity from the Bush administration. He wants full-body scanners, but he doesn't want anybody to particularly know that he is paid to want full-body scanners. That the full-body scanner manufacturing companies are, in fact, his clients. No. No, he just wants to do it to protect the flying public. But these are, after all, and we really can't emphasize this, these are X-ray machines. These are machines that contain little bits of nuclear radiation that are projected into a human body in order to yield up a scan of what the people look like under their clothing. in order to make sure they don't have any bombs. Now, bear in mind that the nature of this is such that there are potentials for defeating this system as well, and that what we are caught in here is the constant loop of better mousetrap, better mouse, better mousetrap, better mouse, ad infinitum, ad eternitum. Or maybe it's better burglar, better lock, better burglar, better lock. Maybe that's the better or closer to home version of the inquiry. Never understanding, as I noted last night, and this is an extension of what we were talking about last night, the fact that if that's the case, then all the terrorist needs to do is set off the bomb at the queue instead of on the plane or in the plane. And when we account for the terrorism in the security queue, all the disaffected terrorist needs to do is set off the bomb at the front gate. And every time we securitize wherever it is the bombs are going off, there's another place for the terrorist to set off an explosive device. And that as we continue to treat the symptoms, we continue to fail to address the root cause, namely the disease, namely why is it these people feel the need to do this in the first place. And such an inquiry, of course, is labeled by the right wing as some sort of squishy kumbaya desire to identify or understand people who are, well, they're just monsters, they're human beasts, and you can't understand them. Well, no, hell no, you can't understand them if you don't even try to understand them, and I don't particularly want to understand them because I want to be like them. Jesus, they participate in a religion that won't let them have a barbecue sandwich. No way do I want to understand them that way or be part of them. Poor bastards can't even have a beer before they fly off to Allah. I don't want to be part of that. I'd like to understand them so we can help stop them. But again, that's just squishy liberalism. But it brings me back to the scanners. There is radiation involved in these. And, you know, me, I fly maybe once every 3 or 4 years. Maybe not even that frequently. And I hate it every time I do. But I will do it as a function of necessity. I do not, however, feel compelled. I mean, if I'm given the choice, sir, would you step through the scanner? No, I won't. Well, we'll have to give you a full cavity search and total. Well, I guess I got to get naked. Let me start getting undressed right here. And why not? I mean, there's indignity involved. There is indignity on a subcellular level involved with these godforsaken scanners. So why not just engage in some indignity on a more immediate and tactile level, as opposed to being radiated and having some little bit of nuclear something or another bounce through my system that will eventually end up with me sitting in a doctor's office in one of those groovy gowns with the open back on an examining room table and my bare ass against butcher paper, while the doctor says, "Well, sir, I've got some news, and I'm glad you're sitting down because," and then to tell you that, you know, on a subcellular level, something has expanded beyond the subcellular to the cellular to the metacellular, and you're being eaten alive from the inside out by human cells gone wrong. Horribly, horribly wrong. There's already enough things in our world that contribute to all of that, some of which we willingly do to ourselves and others, which we have no say-so in, that to add another layer of it via these stupid, stupid, unenlightened, life-in-darkness body scanners at airports is simply unacceptable. Or so say I. And so it was that I noted the passing of Tsutomu Yamaguchi, a man who some would say was fortunate, or some might say lived a horror for the rest of us as a living reminder, who has now gone on. Wherever the candle flame goes when it blows out, I hope he has gone there. I hope he has gone there peacefully. So that is a beginning place for the evening. And a question, if it engenders some discussion, that's great. Because I, for one, you know, I don't believe in civil disobedience for civil disobedience's sake. I believe that you engage in civil disobedience when laws that are designed to protect human beings on a rather objective level begin to be used not to protect human beings, but to oppress and suppress them. And when we are asked to give up more and more of our rights in order to get in an aluminum tube and be hurtled from point to point to get there more quickly, then I believe we have to engage in at first an inquiry. And then, if the situation merits it, we engage in a certain level of civil disobedience. And frankly, if the American public had the courage to simply—and again, remember, we are dealing with the incredibly puritanical, incredibly hung-up American public—but had enough guts to just stand there at the security queue, sir, would you take off your shoes? Absolutely. And start taking off your shoes by removing your shirt, your undershirt, ladies, your brassiere, pants, underwear, and then shoes, and then socks, and standing there naked, then maybe we might draw attention to the fact that our security urge has become an urge that is deleterious to any idea of security. Does this make any sense? I hope it does. Because there are ways of making sure our airliners don't blow up that don't involve the invasion of privacy and subjection to dangerous radiation that is being contemplated. Yes, yeah, that's true, Marty. The tubes are being made of carbon fiber now more than aluminum. But neither substance stands up very well to explosive internal forces or precipitous meetings with solid objects. Because you have to go for lightweight. It's hard. Yeah, I don't think you could make an iron airplane. Well, I mean, there's some armor plating, World War II aircraft. Sure. But this is all part of a larger discussion about how much we will give up in the name of security that can never be complete. You know, me getting on an airplane, I look at the flight attendant as I go up the steps, because I usually don't get to go down one of those boarding hickeys, because, you know, I live here in West Virginia, and we fly these crop dusters out of Beckley, the harrowing affairs at the very least. And I always look at the flight attendant. Is the pilot having a good day? Did he have a good night's rest? He hasn't quarreled with his wife or anything, has he? Good, 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 good. I'll take a window seat at the back of the plane if you don't want. Thank you, ma'am. But that's how I am. But can you imagine if the American people could get unhung up enough about their own bodies to disrobe at a security checkpoint? You know, 50, 60, 70, 100 people at a time. And that we started doing it and persisted with it. Do you think maybe the message would ever finally get through? That we understand that there's no such thing as security? Because I go back to something I asserted a little bit ago, and that is the terrorists have already won. Given what we have already shown ourselves willing to subject ourselves to, they have already won because they have created a terror state. We have transcended the Truman-esque national security state, and we now live in the terror state. when terror is intensely subjective and intensely personal, but is magnified and amplified by governmental responses to it. They have already won because we are already terrorized and terrified, and we have altered our way of life to suit them, which is what they wanted all along. Just saying. So that's a starting place for the evening. It's 27 minutes past the hour, and we will get Friday on the Front Porch started straight away. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
I had to call in early today. I was just like, because I was listening to what you're talking about. I James Carl was worried about it measuring his penis.
Well, many of us are.
Well, no, the thing is that...
We're fragile males, Sandra.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not funny, but the story was funny. I'm like, are you kidding me? But, it's just, the fact that people are actually considering this is mind-numbing to me. And I do, you know how we've had a lot lower travel by air? You know, people are saying it's the economy. I also think, have you been through this hell recently?
Yes, I have.
It's absolute hell. I think a lot of people are like, you know what, later. I do think that some people are avoiding the whole flying experience behind what they put you through. I mean, the shoes, all that shit.
Well, let's take a moment with the shoes for a second, Sandra. Now, the American people have been taking their shoes off for how many years now to make sure that they're, you know, toe jam wasn't going to blow up flight 6921, right?
Right.
What did the shoe examination do to stop our Sudanese, but not really and more properly Nigerian friend, Bupkus?
Well, it's not going to stop nothing when, you know, our CIA is putting them on the plane. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I mean, I'm sorry to say that. I'm being facetious, but, you know, all of it's suspect. And what it does is you have some freak pimping for these scanner machines. Isn't that always the case? It's so disgusting.
What?
Those machines are like cancer. I mean, I'm sure they're carcinogenic. They probably don't even work that well. And I'll say no. I'll stay home.
Or drive. I've already started babbling about how excited I am about Netroots Nation coming up this summer. In what will be sweltering Las Vegas in late July. You know, this is some off-season booking, folks.
Is this a road trip, then?
Yeah, it's a road trip.
Well, no, because, it's just sort of, and the whole idea that we're going to expose ourselves to more x-rays, I mean, I get freaked out by a tooth x-ray if I don't need it, because it's just not cool. You know what I mean?
Well, exactly. And you know,
a broken a bone, yeah. But, I mean, you know, I'm not one to get mammograms every minute. All that stuff, there's a double-edged sword to these.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, if we applied some actual skull sweat to it and we were absolutely possessed by the need to see what's under the clothing without making everyone disrobe, there are other technologies that work. Let me just throw this out there. The video camera that we have is a Sony Handycam, okay? And it's got a technology on it called Night Shot. And it's an infrared sort of thing. But it has this odd, and I read about it long ago and tested it out on Agnes, of course, much to her chagrin. But there's an odd functionality to it that if you turn the lights off and you turn the Night Shot on, it will see through clothing. And there's no little radioactive chip in there. I'm not putting x-rays through somebody but it does do that.
So you're just saying some sort of modification on an infrared night vision type of... No, sure. I mean, this is just, making people submissive. I mean, it's just never-ending what doing this takes care of as far as controlling the populace. I swear to God, I see no other benefits to this because, like you said, this... You know, we still have this freak on the plane with his underwear, you know?
Yeah.
And the scanners, where was it, in England, where they can't look at children? I mean, that's what?
Right, because of the kiddie porn laws.
And I mean, I think, you know, I'm mortified at the thought of going through that just to get on a damn plane. You know what I mean? It's humiliating. That's what I wanted to call about. It's like
total
humiliation is what I'm being humiliated because what the 400,000 intelligence agents can't do their job. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and you know, there's something that sort of goes along with this, and it's a story that's been in the stack for a while and needs bringing up. But there is a report out from a couple of days ago that I saw via Reuters, and the headline simply says, U.S. spy effort in Afghanistan ignorant, according to U.S. report. I'm sure you saw this. And the reason I bring this up is because intelligence is intelligence is intelligence, with all due respect for regard for Gertrude Stein. The U.S. military's intelligence chief in Afghanistan sharply criticized the work of U.S. spy agencies there on Monday, calling them ignorant and out of touch with the Afghan people. Well, guess what? Our entire intelligence superstructure, not infrastructure, superstructure, is out of touch with life in general.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, that's why I laughed hysterically when they expanded it to this homeland security, because like I was saying before, the sort of bureaucratic model is... It begs for what's going on now, for it not to function right. All it becomes is turf battles for budgets.
Yes.
Okay? So to expand it now to, what do we have, like 22 agencies, 15 agencies under the heading of the DNI? I mean, it's just a joke. You know, it's not going to work any better than what it did before 9/11, and lo and behold... It didn't work. If this, if we were to believe this bullshit from the fake bombing, and all they can do is what? Subject the American people to humiliation. That's what we have to get.
Right, and the false dichotomy that's created is okay. Well, we're not going to so we won't send everybody through the body scanners. Only the people who look Arabic.
Yeah, I mean, no, it just goes from bad to worse. I mean, you know, that's a horror show. I don't want to be a party to that. I'm trying to get to New York, and I have to stand there while, you know, other dark people are being... No, I don't want to live. You know what I mean? I don't want to live in that situation. It makes me sick thinking about the whole exercise, you know? I mean, I was freaked out enough when I was flying from London. I had my American passport, blah, blah, blah. I'm on the plane. I'm looking... And I see all the brown people in the room with the window. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was doing my head in. I'm like, oh, and, you know, I was like in my 20s. I didn't know what was happening. But I just thought, what the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
Sorry for the language. But
that's okay. There are what the moments, and they seem to be coming faster and faster, Sandra.
And, you know, so I always been really sort of, you know, sensitive to, okay, you know, national whatever. If you're an American, even of color, you know, there's some perks that go with that when you're traveling.
Yeah, but you know what? If you're traveling in a country in a country that is populated by a majority of dark-skinned people, shouldn't all the white people be put in a room with a window? Because haven't we caused the majority of their problems?
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, and I think you might have a bit of that going on in China. I don't mean to laugh, but you know, the Chinese, they kill me, but. Other places, no, you know, they let, yeah, it's just sort of, I don't know if it's post-colonial, whatever the hell is, it's just sort of, the brown people are always sort of rounded up, you know, and I would have been one of them, except, you know, the American passport, hello.
Yeah, I mean, it's all Captain Reynaud from Casablanca, and round up the usual suspects. Because the usual suspect, you know, and that film, which you may or may not have seen, The Usual Suspect, is a great example here. The usual suspects turn out not to be the people who are the problem.
Yeah, oh, yeah, exactly. No, I've seen that movie. I mean, it's been ages, but I do remember it being quite good. But on the other hand, though, we still had this freak escorted with the explosives, though. And he was all kinds of different colors. You know?
Yeah, and wouldn't you like to, and this is one of those things, wouldn't you like to know who the escort was?
Well, that's, you know, it's like...
You know, khaki slacks, white shirt, necktie, blue serge blazer. Oh, we've got to let him on the plane.
No, I mean, it's just, yeah, that whole narrative is just really troubling, you know. And I'm grateful that at least, you know, Obama mentioned that we shouldn't be under siege. But, you know, like with anything with him, words, you know, I'm looking at that. Yes, that sounds good, Mr. Obama, but...
It's getting to where those pretty words are reminding me of Harvey Korman in Blazing Saddles. You know, you use your tongue prettier than a $20 whore, Mr. Obama. It's funny, but it's not funny.
Well, no, and so I'm looking at it and listening to it, thinking, yeah, that all sounds great, but then, you know, I hear about the scanners. You see what I'm saying? And if that's not subjecting us to a siege mentality, you know, there's a disconnect once again with what he's saying.
But again, the siege mentality doesn't necessarily come from what they're doing, but by our response. If as long as we continue to treat symptoms and not the disease itself, we will continue to have that siege mentality.
Well, you didn't happen to see that little clip of that horrible Todd person, the press guy. What is his name? He slipped up and said "we" instead of, you know, "we conservative." God, what is his name?
Oh, Chuck Todd?
Chuck Todd, yeah.
I read about it.
It was, I looked at the clip, and it was incredible because he was, first of all, he also said that, you know, we don't see any Muslim leaders jumping up or other Muslim leaders. And that was sort of implying, what, is Obama a Muslim leader? You gotta see it because there's so many things wrong with it.
I'll bet you somebody will find it and shoot me the link, and we'll give it a listen in a couple
minutes.
It's
like a minute and 20, you know, it's not even that long. You can look at it.
But then that other, you know, Muslim leaders not stepping up thing is an old, that's a real chestnut for the right wing.
Well, it's a red herring. I mean, it's just a joke, you know. It really is. That's why, I mean, when he was doing it, I'm thinking.
Well, and the thing is, are the Muslim leaders the ones who are, you know, bombing foreign countries and you know, I believe it was Brian last night who mentioned that, you know, the numbers have now been reestimated and we're at 1.3 million dead from Iraq. And Jesus Christ, Muslim leaders didn't do that.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's like Pakistanis are forever asking for the Americans to step up to acknowledge the nonstop killing of their civilians. I don't see Obama rushing out to meet that.
Well, no, because it's kind of hard to meet, because then we would have to sort of take some ownership and some responsibility. And that's for all the prattling and all the talk about the world's last great superpower, which we ain't, on a couple of different levels, we're not very good at. We don't want to take responsibility for things.
Well, that's why it's just getting really tedious. You know, if you, like you, who have some inkling of, you know, geopolitical stuff, it's really hard to hear Obama talking about innocent anybody being killed. You know what I'm saying? Be it Americans or what? It's like, what? What the hell are we doing 24/7, you know? And I know it's real anti-whatever to say, but I'm just being a person here. I'm like, hello, we seem to be killing people left and right, and then some freak almost blows up a plane, and yeah, I'm glad the people didn't get blown up, but let's pretend it's so shocking, you know? I'm sick of that.
And as well you should be. And the rest of the world is trying to tell us, Sandra, what we're doing and what we're doing wrong. I mean, my God, here are the words of Rashid Al-Alimi. And Rashid Al-Alimi is the Deputy Prime Minister for Security and Defense of Yemen. And he said, if there is a direct intervention by the United States, it will strengthen al-Qaeda. Because he understands that the rotten crap that we do over there serves as a recruiting poster.
No, but the U.S., Americans, they have no more excuses sitting around thinking, you know, we're out there doing good. I don't have time for it anymore, Bob. I'm over it. It's like, open the paper, look on the Internet, do something. But lose that. And if you are going to support the U.S., just say what the hell it is that you're supporting. You know what I mean? None of this, we're doing good, they're doing bad. It's so far beyond that now. It's almost embarrassing. It's like, hey, kitty?
And of course, you know, where is there a turnaround spot? Is there somewhere that we reverse these trends? Or would anyone talking like you and I are talking now, and saying this kind of stuff in a much more broadly accessible public forum, would they simply be screamed down by the pants-wetting cowards of the right wing?
Well, you know, round it up, you know, at this point, because it's just getting to a point where, you know, I just sort of, I don't know. I don't even know what to make of it anymore, because we have been inundated with this sort of lifestyle, terror lifestyle, you know, full on, at least since 9/11.
You may have just nailed the thesis to the door, so to speak. The terror lifestyle.
Well, I don't even know what to call it, Bob, because it's just over the top, you know, and it's always.
But that thing's freighted with so much meaning. This is. I mean, somebody signed the surrender papers because they won.
You know, and it's just like, I don't know. And it's not that I wasn't surprised that it wasn't going to go on in the Obama administration, but it's just like, and to hear these freaks saying that nothing happened under Bush again, that Giuliani, I'm like, what is this?
Well, we should just have a rotating Orwell Award that goes to the likes of George Bush. And I heard it the other day. George Bush kept us safe for 7 years. Yeah, but he was in office for 8. There's that one year when he didn't keep us safe, but he gets a pass for it.
Well, no one ever talks about the anthrax. People died behind that, right?
Yeah, and we still and the guy that killed himself probably wasn't the guy.
Oh,
I mean, that's the way it looks. And there was there was an anthrax scare recently, and that was kind of weird because it happened on the same day in Irvine and Alabama.
Really?
Phony anthrax attacks. Just remember what? And they went to right wing Republican congressional offices in Alabama, and I forget who it was that got the bogus anthrax in Irvine, California.
When was this?
In the last week. I had a link to it and really didn't go very far with it. Texas Betsy shot me the link. Maybe she still got it handy and I can go back and review that. But, yeah, real weird. Wingnut offices? I mean, that's just strange.
Wow. Well, and it's just sort of...
But the fact that, you know, you're pretty dialed in, Sandra, and the fact that you didn't catch that, not a criticism of you. That's a, wow, that one went down the memory hole in a hurry.
And, yeah, I mean, you would think that that would be, you know, Diane Sawyer.
Yeah, no.
Every day.
Yeah.
I just mentioned her because I'm like, I don't understand. When did she show up? I'm late. I never watched. But I looked at the news. I thought, what? Is she the anchor now?
That's got to be a fill-in. That's,
and what happened to horrible Charles Gibson?
I think horrible Charles Gibson's on a horrible vacation somewhere.
That's meaningless. It's just sort of, I couldn't deal with the sort of overarching daddy white guys. I surely don't want to look at the dizzy white chicks now. Is that where it's going?
Well, but you know, the thing is, it's all a function of, it's not so much, it's the corporate people.
Well, yeah, it is.
Charlie Gibson was actually kind of folksy back when he was on Good Morning America.
Well, until he decided that every professor earns $250,000, that was like, what?
Yeah, that was a beauty.
I was like, are you?
Where do you? Yeah, Professor Sandra, where do you park your Bentley?
Oh, good Lord. I mean, it's a joke. That was just stuck with me with him. I thought, oh, my God, another clueless, you know, elite reading the news. You know what I mean?
There are, but that's what they all are. With very little exception, they don't live in the real world. Now, the people who sit and read the news at headline news, they're not hauling in the big bucks. Relatively speaking. I mean, they're living nicely, but they're not. You know, they're not making the cutesy Couric money.
Well, didn't she get like $14 million or something crazy?
Oh, it's sickening.
Yeah, I thought it was something really outrageous. Where
I mean, is that what it costs to have nice digs in New York City on somewhere across the street from Central Park? Is that really?
Well, not these days. The way the housing market is imploding in that city. Sorry, I was looking at all the commercial real estate is coming undone there.
I mean, if you had the wherewithal, you could live pretty good in a place like New York right now. And we've got several listeners who live there who could probably expand rather expertly on it. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, what justifies? I mean, did Walter Cronkite make that kind of money? If you adjust for inflation and reduce the present value and all of that monetary mathematical magic, did he make that kind of money? Brinkley, Huntley, did they make that kind of money? What is it that justifies that?
Well, because they're representing an interest that is not the public. You know what I'm saying? That don't cost much. Obviously, it's just corporate, like you said. I mean, it has to be because there is no justification for. I don't believe a media person should be making that much money. I don't know what they are.
And backing up, I've got one half of the story. News Ninja Gene sent this along from bioprepwatch.com. A fifth envelope, this is dated today, a fifth envelope has been discovered at the University of California, Irvine, containing white powder and a message with the words Black Death. The fifth envelope has the same return address as the four others that had been previously discovered. Two envelopes carrying the Black Death message were received on Monday, and a third was discovered Tuesday morning. Buildings they were found in were evacuated. Hazmat team was called to the scene. Powder in the three envelopes was identified as not a biohazard. One of the letters was addressed to a counselor, one to a sociology prof, and one to an engineering professor. The fourth envelope found Tuesday was addressed to an assistant dean of biological sciences in the Natural Sciences 2 building. Who knows? But that's the California Irvine end of it. But then, over in Alabama, something very similar at a contemporaneous time.
No, I mean, wow. And so did they come out with what the white powder was?
No, just non-biological, non-toxic.
Okay.
Probably baking powder.
Yeah.
That's the problem. There's a lot of white powders out there, talc, cornstarch.
Right. No, it's true. Speaking of Alabama, I guess they won.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it was a statewide day of thanksgiving to the Lord.
Yeah, well, I'm so evil because I was laughing at that cult, whatever his name was, trying to throw a ball to his father because he wanted to go back in. I'm sorry. I'm mean.
No. Well, see, I saw that as theater. I don't think that kid's arm was any more hurt than mine is.
Well, whatever that was about, I just thought, what the?
A buddy of mine called last night and said, no, dude, no. He just he got a call from his agent right before the game started saying, son, you don't want to be Sam Bradforded by them. They're big and they're mean and they're strong. Get out of the game. Wait till we get paid before you get that done to you.
Shut up, because I suppose Alabama them people that they built differently than them wet noodles from the Big 12, right, Texas.
Yeah, well, the Big 12. I mean, please.
Oh boy! Well, no, but
it almost got out of hand, Sandra. It almost got out of hand early. Nick Satan was gonna pull out his Bobby Bowden playbook and do some creative play calling. And if the defense hadn't stepped up, it could have been very, very different. The sight of that big dude rumbling and stumbling, doing those little bitty skinny tailback moves, dancing away from a potential tackler on the way to the end zone. That was. I got a lot of love in my heart for a defensive lineman because they don't get to touch the football any more than an offensive lineman does, and when he went rumbling down the field, I was score, baby, score. Even though it was Alabama and I'd promised to root against them, the Alabama upbringing all rises to the top eventually, and you're going roll tide roll.
Well, I mean, but that just means that Saban is in there like he's just. There after this, huh?
Well, I figure he's headed for another job. So, I don't know. Maybe he figures that Alabama is the one place where he could build a dynasty.
Well, no, you're probably right, because they're making rumors about Pete Carroll going to Seattle, but it's really going to be Nick Saban.
You know what? The phone always rings at Nick's house.
He's going to show up in Seattle. No, I'm just joking. I mean, all of it is a bit of a nightmare. I keep going back to you saying, you know, yeah, how much that man makes, you know.
Oh, they showed the bonus. And you know what? I'm ashamed of myself because they put up the comparative numbers between Mac Brown and Nick Saban last night. And lo and behold, Mac had it all over him. You know, $5 million versus $3.5 million. But when you combine winning the conference and winning the national championship, last night Nick Saban got a $400,000 extra paycheck. For winning.
That was the bonus?
Yeah, that was the bonus for winning the national championship.
And the rest of the school gets, don't they send a huge check to the school from the...
Well, theoretically, the school is supposed to get a cut of it, but since I think it actually filters through the SEC and then everybody gets a cut. Because of conference membership. But yeah, I did wind up going, yeah, win, please win. But you know who I felt bad for?
Oh.
Lee Tiffin. Lee Tiffin is the all-time leading scorer in the history of Alabama football. He's the kicker.
Oh, okay.
His daddy is a guy named Van Tiffin, who was a kicker too, and he comes from my old stomping grounds there in the Shoals area of Alabama, and he's a senior. And the last extra point, the last point kick he would ever have as a member of the Alabama Crimson Tide, and he deefed it off the upright.
Oh, didn't make it.
Didn't make it. And he missed a field goal. And the guy was a machine. And he gagged on two last night. And I just felt really rotten for him because, you know, it would have made it 38 to 21 instead of 37-21.
Well, is this somebody that's going to the NFL or is it just strictly college?
No, I think he's done and he goes back into the family business. I think the Tiffin Motorhomes of Northwest Alabama is the family business.
Mm.
But you know, he's had a great career and then to end it with one going thoink off the upright. I was sitting there saying, you know, score one more time. Let him redeem himself. God, there's 26 seconds left, please. But even Nick Saban wouldn't go for one more.
Mm. Well, I guess that's it for what are you going to do now that the football's over? How do you
I go into an ugly period of sort of decompression and depression that is only modestly relieved by the NFL playoffs.
Well, there are four games this weekend.
Yeah.
And
it'll be good. It should be good football.
Well, I'm hoping, you know, that they just finish off Tom Brady because he's been looking kind of shaky. So they can just knock him out. That'd be great.
Yeah, this hadn't been Tom's year.
No, he ain't even looking right. They need to put him out of his misery. And then what's the other
And, you know, we had to put Wayne on suicide watch over the Steelers.
The Steelers good. No, I don't know what happened. What happened? They're done, right?
Yeah, they're done. They finish, 9-7, but they're done. And Baltimore goes in instead of them.
Yeah, but the Patriots, you know, it would just be, I don't know, it's beautiful for my weekend if that was knocked out first round. And to send facelift over the edge for Dallas to lose again.
Oh, Jerry Jones?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there aren't enough rotten things on the cumulatively speaking, there aren't enough rotten things on planet Earth to happen to Jerry Jones to suit me.
That's he's
but I mean that way.
He's horrible. I just would love if after all the, you know, jabbering about the Dallas, I just love to see them, you know, fall on their faces again.
Yeah, I think we got a couple of Dallas fans hiding in the audience, so I got to watch what I say. But
oh, you do.
I've never been able to stand the Cowboys ever.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. You know, I can't say I'm a fan. I mean, in fact, I don't even know most of the teams that get on my nerves because you know I want that Sanchez. I want him to sit down and shut up. I don't.
Oh, God, anyway. a Sunday afternoon hanging out watching football with you, Sandra, would be an absolute blast.
Well, it'd be great fun, because I mean, the sports is like soap, you know, it's like soap opera for men. It's great. It's really easy to relate to when I'm watching it with the few blokes that I know. So, yeah, that would be amusing.
Oh, God. But, you know, we've got some football tomorrow, but then the long darkness comes, Sandra, after the Super Bowl. From the end of the Super Bowl until the Masters in April, there's this period of time where there's no football, no baseball. You can get a little bit of relief with college basketball, but mostly you're stuck with the ABC Pro Bowlers Tour, and, you know, you just want to pluck your eyeballs out and put your head in a bucket of lye and walk off a cliff.
Well, no, it is bad, because then you have really bad NBA. It's not even, you know, it's not gearing up.
See, I don't even count the NBA anymore.
That's what I'm saying. It's just really nothingness, because they have, like, about 20,000 games. So, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter. But, you know, up to the Masters, yeah, that should be interesting to see if Nokia's face comes out.
Oh, and by the way, speaking of which, if you get a minute, you gotta. I can't run it on here because it's just it's too visual for something that's just two guys talking to each other. It's too visual. You gotta go over to YouTube and look for Red State Update, and look for the latest one where they pray for Tiger Woods.
I will, it'll
wreck you, Sandra. It will wreck you.
Well, no, the only reason why I know it's supposed to be a tiger-free zone, but I can't help it because that story I heard just killed me. That fool ain't showing his face, because she actually knocked his face in with a 9-iron.
Oh, Bill, she got all of that mashy niblick.
No.
Right in the sweet spot.
No, so we lost some teeth. And his face is effed up. Anyway.
Oh, and just to give the background, sports consultant David in Tennessee, who is another joy to enjoy, a joy to watch a football game with, filled in the blanks for both of us. Here's how it's going to work. In May of 2010, at the Southeastern Conference Convention in Destin, Florida, the checks from the 2009 bowl TV season will be distributed, okay? The best estimates that are that for each SEC school, each school in the Southeastern Conference, each school will get one check for $18
million. Wow!
Each school. And then the conference gets something similar to keep, you know, just to cover middleman and administrative costs.
Oh, well, no wonder they don't care if your school's graduated or not. Wow, that's...
What a beautiful racket.
Yeah, that's incredible. And then they had a nerve to be giving Reggie Bush and these people a hard time for trying to get a house out of it or something? Shit. That's an outrage.
Well, and that's why I said my buddy was right. You know, Colt McCoy got the phone call and said, don't get broke like this until we get paid.
Well, that's what happened to that freak in Oklahoma for a year, right?
Pretty much, you know, first game of the season, he decided to come back and, you know, have his final senior season, and they broke him in two, and then Oklahoma broke him some more.
Right.
I mean, Texas broke him some more.
I mean, he could have went to the NFL and at least got a paycheck because, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, Colt McCoy, by going out on the third play from scrimmage or whatever it was, I saw several things today, Sandra, that said his draft prospects had gone down the toilet.
All right, so now he's going to miss out on that guarantee money?
He very well may. You know, the free money.
Oh, God. Well,
I mean, it was like an episode of What If Jerry Maguire Had Become a TV Series.
Well, that's funny, though, information about the phone call. I like that. Oh, my God. Well, listen, I guess I know you have other people, so I'll let you move on. But one last thing, it's not sports related, but I see the jobs are coming back. Not.
Yeah.
See those numbers?
Yeah, I did see those numbers, and I think it falls right in line with what Paul Krugman was writing about.
1938?
Yeah, 1937.
37, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I you know, I'm interested to see what next month says. I hope that it's not what I think is, you know, a double dip already, you know?
And the thing is, you know, those are Christmas numbers with people getting part-time jobs at you know, Wally World and stuff, aren't they?
Well, yeah, because I guess in November they revised them, and instead of losing 11,000, 4,000 were actually created. But the only reason why the unemployment rate didn't go up because people stopped. So many people stopped looking completely.
It fell off the list.
Right, so that's why. So that, I mean, it doesn't really bode that well. But I don't know, I'm always, you know, if there's 4,000 jobs were created, I guess, but that just sounds like we have so far to go.
4,000 jobs in a population of 300 million.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, we've turned the corner.
Oh, no, it's crazy. Anyway, have a good weekend.
You too, Sandra. Take it easy. Bye now. That's our buddy Sandra calling from California, and a couple of updates via email from Marty. Hey, Bob, there's the NHL to tide you over until pitchers and catchers report, and the World Cup this year. There's only one problem with this, and I'm going to expose myself as a complete Philistine. I don't understand hockey. And soccer holds utter. I know it captivates the attentions of the rest of the world. Bores me to tears. Sorry. You can start sending the hate mail now. But it just does. And then, you know, poor Marty, here I be a Denver Broncos fan, and the only thing I can do is pull for a Saints versus Colts Super Bowl. Come on, Saints. Yeah. And notes, Marty also notes that Pete Carroll already failed in the NFL, but that doesn't, I'm very certain he's happy with the University for Spoiled Children, which may be true. But by the same time, that money has allowed, that money doesn't talk, that money screams. I've got a clip here from Sue, pointing out Rudy Giuliani today on Good Morning America with George Snuffleupagus. We had no domestic attacks under Bush, but we've had one under Obama. That really does trigger the vomit reflex, doesn't it? Oh my God. Let's see what's going on. Keep it rolling here. No, not that one. How about that one? No, not that one either. Okay, that one. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yes, Bob. It's caller Brian from the state of the great granite state of New Laconia of New Hampshire. And I want to say I just love listening to that sensuously voice, that sumptuous, sublime voice of caller Sandra. Sandra, I want to marry you, kid, and I want to bear your child.
Well, you know what? You may have to get in line, because I think that's about the third marriage proposal Sandra's got on this program.
But tell her I'm just kidding, though. I know she's heading for the... I know even after all this nutty stuff with the December 25th plane, panty waste bomber, whatever, that she's heading for the nearest airport for Indonesia or the Philippines right now. Tell her I'm just kidding. And also, she's from Los Angeles, right?
Further north, I think.
Okay, because I was out in California in the Marine Corps too. But I as a runaway, age 16 and 17, I was out in Los Angeles and Hollywood there, and that's a child molesting capital of the world, or a teenager it was then. But the streets of Hollywood and Los Angeles are mean for any runaway. Stay home.
Yeah.
Don't go there. It's just mean streets. Leave it at that. I'm always a bit intimidated by that city, but I was helped out, I guess it, for a time it left me homophobic in a way, because a young guy like me, a skinny, beaver cleaver looking young man there, I was homosexual molestation or whatever, they try to pull people right over on the streets of Hollywood as a runaway, an agoraphobic runaway in my case, who's got enough trouble getting outside of the door as it is. It's hard, and later on I was helped by the what's called the Gay Community Center there in Los Angeles and Hollywood, who helped me get a job and helped me settle down at least somewhat for my situation there. It's mostly heterosexual really that are the big problem there with runaway girls on Hollywood Boulevard and Hollywood. It's a disgusting It's a disgusting place. It's a dark side of what, you know, what we call the beautiful film capital of the world, whatever you want, the entertainment capital, Hollywood and Los Angeles, California. But that city isn't, it's always intimidated me. But, I need somebody with a strong and, but also a sensual, reassuring voice there that is Sandra, that's somebody who could help me get through, I'm sure.
Well, the whole thing that I think we experience here, writ large, is the fact that none of us are crazy. Because if you just sit there and you've got a half a brain, as this audience, there's more brains in this audience than there is, small as our numbers are, there's more brains here than there are in the entire ditto head nation of 3 or 4 million that Flush Flemball has. And if we were alone, Brian, I think you probably know this for yourself. If we're alone, it's easy to look at this insanity and think that we ourselves are the ones who are going nuts. But by adding together the collective strength of the Sandras and the Juanitas and the Kates and the Hughes, and Kevin and everybody, David from Maine and everybody who calls this program, we can sort of reinforce the fact that we're actually tied down pretty tight. It's the rest of the world that's coming loose and gravity's losing its appeal for.
Yeah, that Sandra, she's going to college right now too, right? Sandra is, or she's going to graduate school or something like that, I believe she said.
Yeah, and teaching too.
I gotta disagree with one thing she said last night was, she blames The Economist. The Economist got us into the economic meltdown of 2007, 2008. I gotta completely disagree with her. The George W. Bush was following the Ayn Randian, Milton Friedman, libertarian, liberticidal, criminal, corporatist, fascist form of economics, phony economics. That's what George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan before him were following, and to some extent Bill Clinton as well. Before them, but they were anti-Keynesian economics. And Paul Krugman, this current president says he would listen to Paul Krugman, any economic ideas he has, the Nobel Prize winner for economics, Paul Krugman. And he apparently has not, really, that's maybe one thing he's gone back on his word. I don't believe he has really consulted seriously Paul Krugman or his advice.
Well, I think we will know once and for all as this year progresses if, as Krugman predicts, this year begins to more and more mirror 1937.
What you're saying,
If President Obama begins listening to the people who have been hooting about deficits all along, who've been hooting about spending all along, if we see President Obama going listening to them as opposed to doing more stimulus, more spending, we will know that the yammerheads have won, and that no, he wasn't listening to Paul Krugman even
a
little bit.
And talk about another great all-American lady there, like Sandra, the great newswoman, true newswoman at Democracy Now, Amy Goodman. Her March 24th interview with Paul Krugman, it's on alternet.org. You can look it up in their archives. Have Geithner's, Tim Geithner's zombie ideas won? Paul Krugman on the Cash for Trash program, and Amy Goodman asked him, Paul Krugman, what would a new system look like, a new economic system? What would you advocate? And Krugman says, like you were just alluding to, Bob, I think in the end we're going to have to go back to something that is kind of like the system that emerged from the New Deal, which was tightly regulated banks and financial institutions, limits on risk-taking, fairly high taxes for high earners, which it turns out that, low tax rates create incentives, but the incentives are actually to play dangerous games with other people's money. A lot of things need to be updated for the 21st century in information technology and so on. But basically, our grandfathers got this thing right. Our grandfathers understood that finance is useful but dangerous. It needs to be very tightly hedged about with regulations, end quote. It goes on from there. It's a great piece there at Democracy Now! Or at alternet.org, March 24, 2009, Amy Goodman with Paul Krugman. And I get a sense that, like you're saying, Amy Goodman's probably consulted Mr. Krugman far more than Barack Obama has.
I think that's probably the truth of the matter.
That's the sad part of it. But and another thing I was going to say, the group you had on the other night there, the musical group, I'm not a heavy metal fan, but, Matt Osborne, the group there, I don't think I could hang with those guys at Florence, Alabama, those Florentine lads there. I don't think I could. You know, they saw a former Marine or not, I'm past that stage. but they just, heavy metal is not for me, but the lyrics, you're right that they're very powerful lyrics, and they're absolutely, you know, totally pertinent to the sad, tragic times we live in today about the, you know, the political, the way it's a takeoff on the Declaration of Independence, and you know, there are founding documents, and this is the kind of, that probably can appeal to a lot of young people, where a professor in a college giving a lecture probably is not going to be able to reach them as easily as this heavy metal band with its powerful lyrics could. I remember is the two most powerful songs of the 1990s to me were, it was, one of them was by the, God Love Him, the guy that he, in 1994, he blew his own head off, Nirvana singer there.
Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, Kurt Cobain, and also Nine Inch Nails there, where Johnny Cash also did a version of that song there. I forget, you can have it all, and you can, it showed the ongoing in the 90s too, even in the Clinton 90s, the ongoing corporatist destruction of America's economy, of America's workers, and it just, you know, you can have all the waste, and then, you know, it ends with the video of it, ends with a powerful scene of an eagle swooping down on a fish, and just say, you know, it just, you know, this is what you're driving us to. This is what it's coming to, you know, whatever it takes. And that's, you know, the anger that's out there, it's only intensified after the 8 years of George W. Bush. I don't think there's any way around that.
Well, it has, but by the yeah. same token, it seems like the if anger qua anger is most manifested by the, you know, by like the teabaggers these days. And
that's not real anger.
Well, no, it's
phony. That's phony corporate anger.
Yes.
AstroTurf. Phony grassroots anger. That's
right.
Paid off anger.
And the people.
Higher mercenary anger, like, you know, like Blackwater claims to be a regular military, like our United States Marine Corps, who should be guarding all our installations now, like they always had for centuries. Or America's great U.S. Army, where my father served in World War II, Italy, and et cetera, on many fronts there. He was nearly as decorated as Audie Murphy, it's true.
Wow.
It just really, but that was our last good war to me, was World War II, and I love my father dearly, but he voted twice for G.W. Bush. I can't understand it. In the 1950s, a younger man, my father, post-World War II, he was more idealistic. He voted for and worked for the campaign for Adlai Stevenson twice in the 1950s, and yet this is, he became more and more with Ronald Reagan and all that. He became, he was a union man all his life, Stevedore Longshoreman, grew up on the streets of Boston, Irish street kid, just as tough as nails, but it just, and he knew everything from the working man's standpoint, and which Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush Sr., that these inbred blue bloods of these
but you know what, you just
have no concept of the working man. They don't
none whatsoever. None whatsoever, Brian.
And Henry Kissinger said of the soldiers, the military, they're just machines to be used for the corporate profits, and, you know, they're.
But Brian, you've identified something there,
okay.
And that is if a hard scrabble guy with a ton of heart and a lot of brains like your dad,
he's a good hearted man.
Yeah, and but if he can get
yeah.
turned,
yeah.
That you just made my head spin. A guy who comes
yeah.
home from the war and rightly, I think, votes for Adlai Stevenson. And then later on becomes a Reagan voter. You know, that's not something that happened to your dad, Brian. That
it happened to the whole country.
It happened to the whole country. But
working class. Yeah.
But there is something deeper at work there, and that is this. It is emblematic of the success at message management that the GOP manifested, as compared to our side. You know, our side went to sleep.
Yeah.
You know, we thought, well, you know, we ran Nixon out of office. We've won. We're going to have good government now. And, you know, the 8 short years later, you've got Ronald Reagan standing there saying, you know, well,
yeah.
well, Nancy, the government is the problem. And
you have to remember, Bob, that Ronald Reagan served in World War II, too. I suffered mightily against the Japanese and the Nazi invaders of America in the film studios, the film studios in Culver City, California, you know, Bob.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was he did his part for the war effort, making VD films.
He was conflating movie stories with actual war, footage or actual combat actions that actually happened in the real history.
You know what my favorite.
Ronald Reagan couldn't separate the two.
Well, there was a great political cartoon once upon a time that showed a caricature of George Washington, and it said, "This man could not tell a lie." And then it showed a picture, a caricature of Richard Nixon, and it said, "This man could not tell the truth." And then it showed a caricature of Ronald Reagan, and it said, "This man could not tell the difference."
Yeah. No, I know. I think that was part of the persona, too. I think, you know, they had like 3 or 4 days, Ollie North destroyed and shredded every single document that had anything to do with President Reagan regarding Iran-Contra. Ed Meese, the so-called attorney general, just as Iran-Contra was breaking, he gave him 3 or 4 days to shred everything. This so-called, Ed Meese was a total corporate whore to Reagan and to the right wing, and he hid whatever information, I'm sure, on Bush Sr. too regarding Iran-Contra, and I believe Bush Sr. ran a lot of those operations too.
But the Republican Party developed a message machine that we had, and they did it with that authoritarian, single-minded, lockstep, jackbooted ability that is their genius for good. You know, there's evil genius and good genius, and that's evil genius. The day after Barry Goldwater was defeated, the core of the GOP got together because, you know, Barry Goldwater didn't just get beat. He got stomped.
I know LBJ was. Yeah.
And the core of the GOP got together and said, never again, whatever we have to do, that will never happen again. And we will become the ascendant party in this country. And they started working that day in November 1964 until it ultimately it bore fruit in Reagan and it bore fruit in George H.W. Bush. But it came to its absolute climax in 2000 with the non-election of George W. Bush.
Right.
And our side, and I'm not going off, this is, you know, I'm sure people are sick of my liberal media rant, but our side has never shown any interest in building an information machine that can in any wise compare with what the right wing has done.
But you and me, Bob, and the average, the working class and the lower class, et cetera, the heart and soul of this nation that built this nation, and the we progressives are hell-bent on trying to build a progressive media, but the elitist, rich liberals, like you're saying, they still don't do media. You know, there's like one, the great exception to that rule is like, you know, the, God love him, the actor Brad Pitt is helping to almost single-handedly rebuild the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans. When George W. Bush and their so-called post-Katrina rebuilding money, $110 billion, most of that went with the private contractors and Haley Bobber's Mississippi criminal, you know, cohorts there. But somebody like Brad Pitt is the exception to that rule regarding liberals and really taking a stake in it. And he should not be needing to do as much as he's had to do. It's a sad state of our affairs now in America, and I believe that Bill Clinton's FEMA would not have allowed anything like the loss of life that happened during Katrina, as George W. Bush's so-called acting federal government did. It was just the private contractors. He had destroyed that with he had that horse trader Brownie. You know, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job as the head of FEMA. It's just a tragedy, and it goes back to Ronald Reagan. And like I say, the Iran-Contra, like I say, they were the people. They armed Hezbollah that blew up the fellow Marines that I knew in Beirut in October 1983. And I'm going back, Bob, and then I'll just leave you, let you go. Alexander Coburn's book, there, Corruptions of Empire. You know, he's actually, I guess he's a descendant from a British general, Sir Walter Coburn, or a thing like that, that actually burned the White House in the War of 1812.
Yeah.
Alexander Coburn.
Yes.
Yeah, he's actually the Senate. But they're talking about Ronald Reagan, the battleship New Jersey was off the coast of Lebanon. Talk about a primitive, cruel, and totally inaccurate weapon there. The 16-inch guns, huge guns of this battleship New Jersey were shelling for weeks and really months before what happened on October 1983. And according to Mr. Coburn, it says, it seems slightly unfair to belabor the battleship New Jersey story with all these criticisms, rather like taunting a stately old bull. As the sailors aboard confess, its purpose is essentially histrionic, to show the flag and strike terror into the foe. In a press conference on October 19th, 1983, Ronald Reagan was repeatedly asked about the security of the Marines in Beirut. The interrogator likened their situation to the French forces at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Then Reagan says, well, maybe the French at Dien Bien Phu in that terrible defeat didn't have a battleship New Jersey sitting offshore as we do. end quote. And 4 days later, over 240 U.S. Marines were blown up, and the New Jersey couldn't do a damn thing about it. If the symbol has to be found for Reaganism in mid-course, playing the high season of nostalgia and grim intentions, the recommissioning of the battleship New Jersey serves very well. That's what Alexander Kolber wrote in Vanity Fair, December 1983. And it's only gotten worse today. He was the absolute best friend of war profiteers and keeping conflicts going, even if he had to go to what was supposed to have been our ostensible Iranian mullahs, you know, our enemy, the funders and the officer corps that ran Hezbollah, and sell them millions of dollars worth of missiles. It didn't matter to Ronald Reagan. You know, it just, whatever it takes to keep the wars going, to keep the conflicts going, and to keep the, you know, to just start calling the Soviet, almost from day one, he was calling the Soviet Union an evil empire.
Oh,
yeah.
And, I mean, God, we could do a week of shows, Brian, on Ronald Reagan.
I remember
when he kicked off his candidacy there in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Where the young civil rights workers were buried in an earthen dam.
Where they were murdered, yeah.
And then later on, he came and kicked off some portion of the campaign in Tuscumbia, Alabama, at the headquarters of the International KKK.
Now, does a really truly ignorant and grandfatherly, charming man really do that kind of thing, like start the campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1980, unless he really knows the, you know, like an advertising, a cynical, manipulative advertising executive or propagandist for any evil government. He knows what the signal he's sending out there, talking about states' rights there in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
again, to these Republicans, states' rights means nothing when it's the 2000 election in Florida's constitution.
No, it only means something, Brian, when it means making sure that the scary dark people don't get your white women's.
Disgusting. But one more thing, Bob, I'll let you go. Like I say, I can't get into the heavy metal. Like maybe if I just read the lyrics of that young man's song, the Viking Lad song, if I could just get into it that way. But my speed is more, I've got some recent MP3 CDs of the old radio show. I don't know if you've heard of it, the Bob and Ray show.
Oh, God, I love Bob and Ray.
Ray Goulding and Bob Elliott, yeah. And just at oldradiofun.com, folks, you go there, you get there, they're about $5 each, including the shipping, and you get like hundreds of shows you can get if you get both of the MP3 CDs. But Bob and Ray, and they had like, it goes back to 1948-49 from Boston, was where they were doing WHDH studios there, House of Television ads, and all this air conditioning installer ads, and Ray Goulding would play the installer, of course, and Bob Elliott would interview him. But they also had their newsman was Peter Gorey, a fictitious newsman, you know, like Peter Lorre.
Yeah.
The actor, and he had that, I can't do a great Peter Gorey, but he said, like, well, Bob and Ray, you know, in the news, we have a tragedy to report. There was a spectacular accident, a speeding freight train collided with a school bus today in Wellesley, Mass., but unfortunately, none of the school children were on the bus at the time, and the driver himself was on lunch break, and he stupidly left the bus on the middle of the train tracks, and there was, unfortunately, Bob and Ray, I have to say to you, there were no injuries, there were no casualties that I can report to you,
You know what? Those guys knew. I mean, they knew if it bleeds, it leads. You know, it's one of the ugliest old facts of journalism, whether it's print, radio, or TV. If it bleeds, it leads. You know, Don Henley came along a few years later and encapsulated all of that perfectly with that great song, Dirty Laundry. You know, the bubble-headed bleach blonde comes on at 5. She can tell you about the plane crash with a gleam in her eye. It's interesting when people die. Give us dirty laundry.
No, I don't. Well, Bob and Ray, I hope to have more carnage to report in the next update in the next hour there. And now, folks, now back to Bob and Ray.
Yeah. Hey, Brian, I got to roll, brother, but it's been a great conversation. You have a wonderful evening.
To play there. Here we go. Here's Bob and Ray.
Public radio program. I want to introduce an old and dear friend of ours who called our office this afternoon and said he had an important announcement to make. And could he have a few seconds on this show today? Webley Webster, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, thank you, Bob. I wanted to come by and make the announcement that I'm going to have an evening with Webley Webster.
You know, we've got a lot of people ask us about
that. The microphone. I'm sorry.
We've got a lot of people ask if you were going to repeat that great success you
had. No, it's not going to be a repeat. It's going to be a brand new program.
Oh, it is.
We'll have poetic recitations, and I'll play the organ much like Mr. Free.
Really?
Only it's a pipe organ.
Yeah.
I wouldn't use one of those things.
What's the matter with that?
They sound tinny. I like the big pipe organ.
All right. And where are you going to open? Where's the opening
for? William, New Hampshire will be my first concert. They have a lovely theater there.
You played there before?
Yeah. I have a built-in acceptance in Prince William. I'd like to go back there.
Good place to start, and we want to wish you a lot of luck. Well,
thank you, Larry. You always know it's a pleasure for me to come by and talk to you, fellas.
I'm Bob.
Oh, right.
Let us know how it turns out. We also want to tell you that our sponsors are again with us tonight. The Einbinder folks, the greatest name in fly paper.
And by Monongahela, the metal foundry that casts ingots. With the housewife in mind.
And now Mushy's, the great new cereal that gets soggy even without milk or cream, brings you another exciting story of adventure starring Tippy the Wonder Dog. As we look in on the isolated cabin of Grandpa Witherspoon today, we find that a herd of cattle has broken out of a nearby corral and is stampeding through the valley. Gramps has crawled underneath his cot in a desperate effort to escape the approaching stampede, as little Jasper stands in the front window, gazing out at the quiet lull before the storm. Suddenly, the boy turns and speaks.
No cows out there now, Gramps. Do you think maybe it's just the quiet lull before the storm?
Yeah, I'm sorry, all you bet your boots it's just the quiet lull before the storm. That's why I sent that fool dog of yours out for some barbed wire to string around our property before the stampede gets here. Those critters aren't cows like you seem to think, boy. They're full-grown steers.
Okay, sorry for the incorrect terminology, Crash. But aside from that, you don't need to worry about a thing. Tippy will be here with your barbed wire momentarily. Why, he's the dependablest, the smartest dog in the whole wide world.
Well, concern it all, where is he then? I sent him to the store early Saturday morning.
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of barbed wire to choose from. It always takes Tippy a while to select his purchase when it involves comparison shopping. I'm sure he'll be along soon. Tippy's the finest, the smart... Oh, hey!
Huh?
I think I see him out there now, Grass. Headed home lickety-split to save us from getting trampled. Here, Tippy!
Concern it all. Give me that barbed wire, quick. I can hear those cattle stampeding right outside the door.
Oh, I think it was just your vivid imagination, Gramps. I didn't hear anything. Besides, that wasn't Tippy out there after all. It was just that Airedale of the Pagets. He was headed home with a case of electric cattle prods. Batteries included.
Yeah, concern it all.
Okay, Bob, well, they have much funnier bits, too.
Well, no, it's classic, right?
But believe me, folks, I excerpted that. I know airtime is precious, and I'm, you know, it matches even the quality of the, like I say, that young musical group you had on there. There's really some funny stuff there. It's just great. And Peter Gore, you know, if you could do a good Peter Lorre, you could do a good Peter, the great newsman there. And they have Mary McGowan, she sings fight songs from various big universities and colleges there, and they have great old Christmas as there too, and all. Radio was never as thoughtful as it was in those days, and we need to get at least some of that back again, if at all possible.
Oh, radio theater is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of like great shows like Bob and Ray, and all kinds of great sci-fi and westerns, and any kind of classical radio show there going up into the 60s and 70s. This place, oldradiofun.com, has it. I have no personal interest in it. It's a young man from San Antonio, Texas, runs it. Oldradiofun.com, and it's just a few bucks for each MP3 CD. You can get many, many hours of programming, great programming from that. And that it goes back to the days when people act. I don't know. They were using their mind a lot more on radio, on like they don't.
Well, it's
more,
and more that's the one thing. It doesn't.
You're not on there.
Well, that in large part, yeah. But again, radio is active listening, whereby television is passive presentation, and that's what makes this all so special. Brian, have yourself a great weekend.
Have a good weekend, sir. And I'm sorry, Sandra. I may have to consult a divorce lawyer in preemptively if you already got three other suitors ahead of me. So, God love you, though. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Take care, Brian.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And we will keep things rolling, or try to at least. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Hey.
Tobias here.
What's up, Tobias?
Trying to stay in out of the cold, and it's getting harder and harder.
Well, the cold isn't going anywhere. That's for damn sure.
Yeah.
I looked outside at the rusty red truck, and it is covered up again. So I anticipate probably as soon as the show is over, I'll have a honeydew on my hands and have to go out and buy milk because we seem to be going through that stuff like it was water.
Right.
And I don't look forward to it.
Take it. Well, you leave it outside, it turns into ice milk.
That's true.
Take it from me, a man of the cloth, that I don't know what kind of cloth that's supposed to be, but okay.
Muslin. We'll choose maybe a nice damask.
It's so cold, hell is officially frozen over, and the devil's got icicles hanging off his nuts. I mean, it's just cold. I mean,
yeah, ugly cold, and like I said, I think the kids were supposed to go back to school here this Monday past. They have not been to school all week.
Same here.
And I think we are getting pretty close to something that's going to be. I don't know. There may be cannibalism involved if we die. They're going a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
Because they're early teenagers and they're sick of us, and we're ready for them to go to school for 8 hours a day. We love them, but it's time for them to go to school.
Yeah, it's like,
you know, as a parent, and I it's one of those things that you only learn, Tobias, once you're a parent in your own right. I used to drive my father crazy with two words: I'm bored. And I never understood why he would be infuriated by my boredom. But having had that litany repeated to me on more occasions than I care to admit over the last several days, I've got it. I've got it absolutely down to the ground now.
Words you never said to my father, as I said.
Oh, I only said it a few times.
Fiercely Scotch-Irish, and he could even give you work to do. Because, you know, boredom was a plague of God, and well, by God, if you're a bored boy, we'll find work for you to do, because that's the only thing that, you know, that's what you need, that's what you're here for. And, well, and this is a true story. When I was with my brother and I were youths.
Youths.
Yeah. During the summer, off from school, we had been off, you know, this is back when you got 2 months off school, you know. 2 days after, 2 days into our summer break, my father took us outside and demarcated off a ditch that he wanted, this mythical ditch he wanted dug with spade and mattock and our backs, and it was to be 2 feet wide, 3 feet deep, and 100 yards long. And it took us all summer to dig it, and we were allowed to work on it 6 days a week.
Not on Sunday.
And the day we got it done, he went to the barn and got his tractor, and he filled it in. And my brother and I occupied our time the whole time we were digging it. Now, we had no idea he was going to fill it in.
That's kind of brutal, Tobias.
And he was like, we were like, well, what's he going to put in this? You know, is there a culvert going to go in here? Because it doesn't really connect anything. You know, is he going to wonder, you know, what's the purpose of this ditch? And as soon as we got done, of course, we made no money for doing this. He filled it in. And that's the most rage as a 12-year-old I ever had for my father. I wanted to split his head open with a spade. And I'm like, why did you fill that in? He said, because I didn't need it. And then why did you have us dig it? He said, to keep you boys out of trouble.
That's a tough nut to crack.
And I tell people that story. I said, because you say, well, I never met your father. I said, well, that's all you need to know right there.
Idle hands are the devil's plaything, boy.
Right. This is the guy who, while up at a barn 40 acres from the house, while they were castrating bulls, one kicked through the wall and kicked him in the knee and bent his leg back the other direction. And he walked home on it to have my mother drive him to the hospital. And then argued with a nurse for 45 minutes because they wanted to cut his jeans, and his foot had swollen so much they had to cut his boots off. And he said, no, these are brand new Red Wing boots. You're not going to cut them off. And the nurse was like, you could lose your foot. And he said, well, if I lose my foot, I won't need the boot. and wouldn't let her cut. He said, you can cut the, I'll compromise, you can cut the laces.
And you know, that's why the Scots conquered the world.
And, you know, it's like people say, well, you know, they got, it's all made up, this whole frugal Scots thing. I said, you obviously never met my old man. I said, he pinched a penny until the heads and tails were on the same side of the coin.
Yeah, hey, boy, what are you reading with your glasses on? Nothing, Pa. Take them off, you're wasting them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can sit closer to the TV, boy.
But the fact is that ethic really did change the face of the planet. God knows, and I highly recommend for anyone who doesn't own it, I recommend the ownership of Joe Bajant's book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, because he goes into that at great length. You know, the effect of the Scots Irish on Appalachia.
Well, you're right. That's the people. That's our lineage. That is Appalachia. My entire life, I thought my father was allergic to strawberries because I love them. Come to find out, he loves them because I found it from his mother. He said, oh, yeah. No, George loves them. I'm like, I've never seen the man eat a strawberry. And my grandmother was the one that ratted him out. She's like, oh, we used to grow them when they were kids and picked them and sold them. Right after the Great Depression, when things were hard, you know, they came right after. Because, like most large Scotch families, they had two sets of kids. And my dad was in the latter set of children. And the older kids raised the younger ones, you know.
Yep.
And they had to pick and sell these berries. And he was like four or five or six, you know, just getting, you know, and they had to go down there and work in these berry fields. And he got caught picking and eating berries, and my grandfather wore him out. And he swore to his father, I will never eat another strawberry as long as I live. And I know because I buried him. I never saw the man put a strawberry in his mouth. And apparently, well, we have it on good faith that from the time of that incident, when he was like five until he was 64, he never ate a strawberry because of that. Because he had to pick them and sell them and wasn't allowed to, because he got a spank, you know, because he got punished severely for eating a berry that they were supposed to sell.
Well, you know, Jeff Biggers, in his seminal work, The United States of Appalachia, talks about the fact that it was cranky Scots-Irish hit the drunken hillbillies who went over the mountain and, you know, via a forced march and changed the tide of the American Revolution at the Battle of King's Mountain. But that kind of frugality, if you will, that kind of hardness, frankly, is the heart and soul of that care. You know, I don't know if they were like that before they got on the boat, but they damn sure were like that after they got here and had to eke out an existence. You're absolutely right. You know, that coincides with that great old saying that the English came and built a house, the Germans came and built a barn, and the Scottish came and built a still.
Right. My dad worked full time for the Louisville Railways, which became Chesty, which became CSX, you know.
Right.
And of course, they hauled coal for everybody. And he retired from there, but he also farmed cattle, Black Angus cattle, full time. And he brewed wine his whole life. I still have a wine cellar full of his wine. And I have, as a matter of fact, I have the last bottles of wine he ever bottled. And they bottled whiskey. I mean, they had a distillery and put together whiskey, and you know. And so yeah, it's all that the craft things. You know,
yeah,
it's all work of the hands.
I've taken to saying something within the groups that I work with or work among that we Appalachian people were sustainable before sustainable was cool. And if you're talking about making wine or making beer or making mead or doing your own liquor or, you know, raising your, all of those things were things that our forebears knew how to do before we forgot how to do them. The Appalachia, for all the, you know, oh, there's so much poverty in Appalachia. It was only poverty to people who were on the outside looking in. who thought that we didn't have all the modern conveniences.
My grandmother, my father's mother, showed me where she had the ration books from the Great Depression filled with cards, but they were never used. Coupons were never used because, like, for the point you indicated, she's like, well, those were for really poor people. We had, because they had 4,000 acres of land, which I have a copy of the original land grant with my dad's family, came through the Cumberland Gap. When Kentucky was a territory, they bought 15,000 acres of land for $15 silver. Not a bad deal if you can get it.
No, not by any stretch of the imagination.
I've still got a copy. I've got a photostat of the actual original land grant where they bought it. And that got whittled down over time, and my mother still owns the last parcel of that land, which is 390 acres. Which will presumably one day go to me and my brother, which is the only two left.
So do you have any skills in the Black Angus raising, whiskey making, wine making, beer brewing?
Wine making check and Black Angus raising check.
Yeah, probably don't have enough land to grow the barley, do you?
No, nor the skill. I mean, I just don't. Of course, being the rebellious son, I rebelled against my father. Didn't want to farm, and now, of course, seek to.
Right.
Do those things for my own personal.
And you know what? If at some point, Tobias, you can carve out a niche, doing as your father did, and, you know, no antibiotics, no hormones, you know.
Well, see, that's the thing. Where I was
beef that's beef.
The last thing he gave me when he was diagnosed with terminal cancer, when he sold off his herd, he took the last Black Angus steer he raised. He kept one steer, the smallest one, and he raised it up, pastured it, and he took it to slaughter. And gave me half of it and my brother half of it, split it down the middle, you know. And I still have a few steaks of it in my freezer. And that is the best, I mean, that's been the best beef we've had. I mean, I had a tri-tip roast that was somewhere on the neighborhood of, you know, 22, 24 pounds. I had to have it, you know, had to take it back to have it split because it was just like, it's a beautiful animal, and it was no antibiotics, all grass-fed, all, you know, free-range beef, and that's what he, and that's my, that was the last animal he raised, and he gifted it to me and my brother, and, you know, it's just been, and I've in turn, they filled our freezer up, and when we got it from the slaughterhouse, we in turn gave it some to our next-door neighbors who are friends of ours, and here, you know.
Oh, it's got a wonderfully different flavor from anything that comes out of the grocery store, you know, especially now that beef at the grocery store is being injected with pink ammonia slime,
mm-hmm.
to render it safe for human consumption.
Kill all the E. coli.
Our buddy David in Tennessee, not that terribly far from where you are, I don't think, just dropped a note and said, yeah, the Scots-Irish, that resolve started with Flinty. And then it develops a greater determination from there. And it's the absolute truth. Because on the one hand, there's nobody has fun like the Scots. But when they're not having fun, they're some mighty serious people.
But, I mean, we dabble around. Now, I'm not musically inclined a bit, and sadly, and there's some great musical traditions that come out of it.
Oh, well, yeah, without doubt. I mean, the concept of the Cayley is...
been to many, you know, and the seeds of the roots of bluegrass music are sown in the seeds of all the Scotch-Irish folk music that came.
Oh, sure. What is it? Billy Boy comes from Lord Randall, and yeah. Yeah. So, this being Friday and all, you're just going to try to weather the weekend through the miserable cold snow? Or, I mean,
tomorrow we're supposed to get, it's supposed to turn off really cold here, and in the negatives, so.
Well, I guess I'm going to go off in my, I've got one of those little, you know, for emergency heat purposes, and it just makes me really nervous. For emergency heat purposes, I've got one of those little, it's called a heat buddy, I think, or something like that, where you screw in the propane, the Coleman propane bottle.
We used to have those.
But there hasn't been a Coleman propane bottle to be had anywhere around me for weeks. So I may go out on my grand search for those again tomorrow, because I just hate the idea of not having some sort of emergency backup heat handy, what with having little grandbabies in the house. I hope I find some, but I was told that the factory's actually behind schedule because everybody's been hammered, especially with the massive power outages.
This is global climate change. You know, I don't like the term global warming because then the idiot know-nothing sees on it, like the Palins, because it is the rise of the know-nothing. I always say that now that we're in the 21st century, we're in the post-facts generation. Facts mean nothing. You don't have to have them. You know, people like the Palins of the world, they are the new know-nothings, the Glenn Becks. They don't need facts. Facts mean nothing. It's just shout the loudest and have people. Yeah, when I read the statistic that less than 1% of Americans read one book or less a year, you know, print is dead. People don't read. They don't. Facts mean nothing. If you can get on, it's like Rudy Giuliani can say, you know, Bush had no domestic terrorism, you know, in his tenure. Okay. You know, what about the anthrax attacks? What about the shoe bomb? What about all the? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you say. You know. And they're not, and of course the media is not going to challenge him on it. You know, people like Oberman will on another program, but the news reader, the bubble-headed bleach blonde, if you will, sitting right across from him won't say, excuse me, that's inaccurate.
No, because that would be deemed to be a contrary opinion. And that's, I think you've identified one of the root problems we face here, Tobias, and that is the difference and distance, if you will, between journalism and journopinion. That's the phrase that I coined for what we're doing here. On the one hand, I try to deal with facts. I try to offer facts, and all of us try to deal in facts in our conversations.
Sure.
Now the things that we extrapolate out of them are separate entities that are opinion-based, so hence the word journopinion. Because journalism should be who, what, when, where, why, how, and occasionally how much.
Right.
Anything that deviates from that is not journalism. But the problem is that journalism, especially by horrendous practitioners of the horror itself, like Fox, tender opinion as fact, tender opinion as journalism, with no warning whatsoever to the unsuspecting person, so that when you try to present facts, now that's just the other slant on what Fox said. No, it's not a slant, dadgummit. These are the facts. What you got from Fox is opinion.
Right.
But the whole thing is blurred and grayed, and it's all just been mixed together. So that it's harder and harder to sort out what, I mean, my God, I've got this, what Sandra referenced early in the program. I've got the audio of Chuck Todd here, and this is a perfect example of it. I'm going to run it here while we're talking just so we can share it. There's no better example. This is Chuck Todd doing a stand up for NBC News outside the White House. He's appearing on, Hardball with Tweety Matthews, it all has to do with whether or not President Obama's doing enough to fight the terrorism. Never mind the fact that there has yet to be an amorphous, inconcrete noun, and it's impossible to fight. But never mind. But that's what the subject matter is. So let's go to NBC's Chuck Todd, if you will.
At this point.
Well, let me go. So, Chuck, do you think he can hold this line that we're going to remain a liberal society in terms of human rights and trial by jury and habeas corpus and Miranda, and also not get really angry in a reactive way at the Islamic world generally, not to be get that bunker mentality that Israel has to take from time to time when they just get, hey, the whole neighborhood hates us, we got to be reactive to that. Can he keep us from that point of view and that mentality?
Well, I think it's tough, but you know, the greater challenge is that there aren't enough
There aren't enough other Muslim leaders around the world who stand up and criticize al-Qaeda publicly enough. You know, this is the great challenge.
Did you catch that? There aren't enough other Muslim leaders around the world.
Yeah, implying that Obama's a Muslim leader.
Plain and simple. He flat out asserted it, Tobias. But it gets worse. Let's continue.
Challenge here, I think, and this is what makes it, I think, harder for him to win this argument with the right in this country, is that there aren't enough examples around the world where we have leaders of other Muslim nations who stand up and loudly yell, these guys in Yemen.
So we are a Muslim nation now, I guess. Other Muslim nations. Wow, what a horror Chuck Todd is.
Men are thugs. They're bastardizing Islam, and this is not what it is. And that, I think, has been this challenge, because I think the president, you know, believes this in his heart. I think he believes that 99% of Muslims around the world believe that this is not a violent religion, an extremist religion. But there is so much fear in the Middle East among some leaders of some of these countries and that they're going to be toppled by this extremist movement that they're afraid to speak out about it. And that, of course, puts the president in a box here politically with his own domestic critics, because we sit there, I think you see conservatives sit there and say, hey, it doesn't...
And there it is. We sit here, I mean, conservatives sit here, let's just go, just hear it again.
And say, hey, it doesn't seem like the Muslim world wants to stop these guys.
And yet the Muslim world, the leadership...
You know, when you think about the legacy of real news people out there, that's just sickening, Tobias.
Edward R. Murrow spins in his grave.
I think he's rotated all the way through the planet, and he's somewhere out in independent orbit at this point, Tobias.
What I always like is like when Tweety, you know, prefaces the, do you think we can remain, you know, a nation that respects civil rights with a habeas corpus. Well, first of all, that all was thrown out the window under the last guy, and it wasn't put back. Obama didn't put it back. And to do that, we'd have to throw out the Military Commissions Act. That's what threw habeas corpus under the bus.
Yeah, he is, to use a phrase out of the law, assuming facts not in evidence.
Right. And everyone keeps doing that. We're still legally wiretapping. We're still surveilling. We're still doing all this stuff, and everyone... You know, it's like, if you focus over here, I always use the analogy of there's a reason that magicians or illusionists wear white gloves and have a really scantily clad babe standing on a stage. It's like, look at the pretty girl. Don't look at what the hand I don't want you to focus on is doing. Look at the hand I want you to focus on. You know, it's all misdirection. And that's what they do constantly. It's, you know, they get the mouth breathers on TV to breathlessly tell you, you know, and scream and rend their garments and wonder, oh my God, you know, is this important? And all these shows, which aren't even new shows, they're just opinion shows. It's like seventh grade all over again. Susie said, you told a lie. You know, let's go to Susie for a reaction. Well, Billy said this. Let's go to, you know, and they just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it's like, God, can we get any real? Can we cut through any of this and get real? And the answer is no, because television journalism, which is an oxymoron, is designed to obfuscate. If you actually screw up and get some info or get some truth, it's completely accidental.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the pharmaceutical products commercials where they screw up and tell you the truth. Usually in the product, you know, the liability things at the code at the end, you know, product may cause spontaneous pregnancy, alien abduction, or death. You know? It's like, well, I don't think I want to take that. And you go, oh, okay.
Yeah, and our buddy Marty adding in, at least Mr. Todd didn't insult Islam itself. Yeah, I don't know. That got pretty close as far as I'm concerned. Hey, Tobias, I got to roll, brother, but have yourself a great weekend, and we will talk soon, okay?
Oh, you too.
All right. Later. Stay warm.
Bye.
Bye now. And it's about 4 minutes before the hour. We will take our top of the second hour break. We haven't taken a break thus far, at least not much of one that I can tell. We'll come back to your phone calls. You know the number, of course, 877-443-2366. If you want to do it on your nickel, it's 304-658-3333. Email rolls in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. It's also terribly easy. Jump into the chat room if you've never been there. I'd love to see new faces in there, and got a nice little crowd in there for this Friday on the front porch. This seems terribly, terribly appropriate under the circumstances. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn.
You can throw your luggage down, lose your cool and stomp around, but there's nothing, nothing you can do. Wipe away your girlfriend's tears, go to the bar and have some beers. There ain't no way that bird's getting through. No plane on Sunday, maybe one come Monday. Just a hopeless situation, make the best of all you can.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Brock.
A minute past 8 o'clock here on the East Coast in the Eastern Standard Time Zone. I'm Bob. And part of the reason, part of what prompted that last song, Jimmy Buffett's No Plane on Sunday, what should we call this? I guess the American Hysteria Files. We go to beautiful downtown. Nah, not really downtown. Not really beautiful. We go to Newark. This hit the wires in the last day or so. Let's see. We had the story of the Bakersfield Airport being shut down over honey. We had the hissy in the hissy in Minneapolis, and now you see a headline like "Kiss shuts down Newark Airport." You're thinking maybe Gene Simmons and Peter Chris and Paul Stanley were walking through Newark Airport, and there was a mob scene that No, not that kind of kiss. Not that kind of kiss at all. No, the entire Newark airport was shut down due to a kiss. A KISS kiss. A bus. A smooch. You know how it is when you're in an airport. And you're saying goodbye to someone that you're horribly infatuated with, perhaps in love with, perhaps have been in love with. Saying goodbye sucks. And frankly, there's no small amount of romance and scenes of romance that have been shot in airports. There's nothing. My God, think about the scene on the tarmac. Think about the scene on the tarmac with Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart. The slouched hat and I'm staying with you, Rick. You're going to get on that plane with Victor Laszlo, because if you don't, you'll regret it. Maybe not now, maybe not tomorrow, but forever, the rest of your life. Get on that plane. And you've got to be dead from the center all the way outward. For that not to just rip you to pieces. Man, what a moment. Well, gone are the days. A man stepped over a checkpoint cordon line for a kiss. He wound up in what is deemed a secure area for one last goodbye smooch at the C1 security checkpoint in Newark Airport. A TSA officer, non-union of course, was supposed to be standing in the area, and the woman raised a rope to allow the man to go underneath to allow them to walk hand in hand to the boarding area. Jesus, that's just sweet. And the entire airport went into full-on sweat condition alpha over it. Just another story from the hissy files. The kissing hissy is what we'll call this story. And we'll also go on back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
There are very few men I say this to, but I love you.
Well, I'm kind of sweet on you, too, Kevin. But...
by the way, there's just so much stuff to cover. Tobias said a mouthful as far as I think his father and my father must have some common ancestry somewhere along the line, even though, we've talked about how the Scots-Irish came into the Caribbean, too.
True, and, yes.
Yeah, because, I'm descended from Jamaican hillbillies, basically, and I have, and like the region of Jamaica where I'm from is known for Scots-Irish settlement, so. But like some of the stories he told me growing up kind of remind me of my dad and my uncles and my granddad, I guess it's a very common strain in DNA all of us, in all of us, wherever we go. But that being said, and the reason why I say I love you is because there was a conversation before that with, what's his name, from Vermont, I think, in New Hampshire.
Oh, from Brian?
Brian.
In New Hampshire, yes.
Yeah, you talked about Philadelphia and Mississippi. Okay, where Reagan launched his campaign off of Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Yeah.
And then you said the comment, well, to keep, you know, what's from the Whopper, you know.
Right.
But the thing is, to me...
It's true, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, you know what? How about keeping the white women from us?
There is that. And but see that's just the polar opposite, because it's all tied in with that weird ass white male sexually insecure paranoid Johnson shrinking fear, and that, because on the one hand, you know, they're going to get our white women, but implicit in that fear is that the white woman's is going to want to get got.
Yeah, put it this way, any man that has a pulse and is capable of protecting his woman, which nowadays means making dollars, no longer, it's genetically burned in.
Yeah.
The woman's DNA to seek protection from a man. Okay? And all you have to do is have half of faith. You know, women are going to be available to you.
Well, I've never had that luxury, but I'll take it on faith.
Okay, and that's all.
I'm not going to sit here and tell stories of all the nights I wound up at the bar of Last Resort in college. Okay, you know, the one that doesn't close till 3.
Oh, that one.
Yeah. Everybody knows one.
Yeah. But my thing is, if I, you know, part of the big reason for Tiger Woods is not. Okay, the man's a billionaire. Women are going to make themselves available for him. And I'm not saying all women are gold diggers, but that's just the whole cold. He's going to attract a
Yeah,
person.
But hey, at least Tiger bought American.
Yeah.
That was pointed out to me in a recent conversation. You know, Tiger didn't jump in a plane to fly off to Argentina to meet his soulmate on the public dime.
Exactly. But not only that, I think the issue with Tiger Woods, okay, besides a black male expressing his sexuality.
Now wait a minute. Now you have to, no, the lingo has changed, Kevin. He's a black Buddhist male.
Okay.
You have to include the Buddhist part in there now, or else Britt Hume will get all pissed off.
How many layers does the bigotry run?
It's an onion.
Yeah, it is. Believe you me, I've experienced it. And in very weird ways, which you don't have enough airtime to explain how. You know, it's just, you know, it's not, you know, besides that, but also the thing is, America has a fetish for blonde. And his wife was blonde, and he did a blonde dirty.
There's
a played a blonde.
She's a Swedish blonde. I mean, you want to talk about a subset of a subset, a fetish of a fetish of a fetish.
Exactly. So.
I mean, half of America just wants to see her in the St. Pauli girl dress.
Exactly.
Of course, half of America doesn't realize that that's German and not Swedish, but they don't care.
They don't even, yeah, well, this is the know-nothing country, like Tobias said. You know, facts tend to be, and that's the thing, and it's like every time a blonde girl wants to head down to the Caribbean and mess around with the natives, it makes headline news for months. And the thing is, I'm willing to bet you if it was a white woman, dark hair, it wouldn't make that much headline.
No. No, and of course, you know, the number one selling hair dye in this country, not by brand but by shade, is far and away blonde.
Well, we all know America's a fetish for blondes. That, you know, and taking from experience, is that sometimes the roofing and the flooring don't match, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, the rug don't match the drapes.
Yeah.
I'm going to catch you. You know, you're doing this to me on purpose, Kevin.
Well, okay. We can say because, I forgot. Sorry, hon. Sorry.
If Agnes was still back here producing, ears would be ringing by now from the whomp upside the head with the iron skillet.
Yeah, exactly.
But see, now wait. I do have to offer this brief moment of sort of mea culpa or expiation or something. I'm rather impervious to blondes. They don't exercise the power over me that they do many men. I've got something worse, Kevin.
What? Redhead.
I got the redhead problem.
Oh yeah, well that's cool too. You know
I married one. And chased a million of them. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's that Scots thing again. Maybe that's tonight's Friday on the front porch theme. You know, hi, I'm Bob, and I'm of Scots Irish extraction. Hi, Bob. You know, and I can't help it.
Well, to me, I tend to date women who kind of look like my mom. You know, call it whatever it is. You know, but it's just the, which was basically either very light-skinned, black, Latina, Middle Eastern-looking women. They all kind of look like my mother and my aunt, and most of them in my family. You know, like...
Wow.
Women, you know, that's just the way it is. So that's what I tend to date. That's what I married, even though that blew up on me big time. But, hey, you know, like I said, blondes are good, too. I've dated a few blondes, but, you know, redheads, I think I dated one redhead, you know. But... You know,
and the thing is, if you date the redhead and you survive it, you're either hooked forever or you've been suitably warned away.
Exactly. But anyway, let's change the subject so Agnes doesn't kill you.
That's a rather good idea, but you're going to lead me into something else. You're in one of those moods tonight, Kevin.
Okay. The reason why Dick Cheney, and this is going back to the whole news thing now. Okay. Dick Cheney will never answer for his crimes. And I think Dick Cheney is, and Rumsfeld is right up there with Adolf Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, who deserve to be held accountable for war crimes. And it's never going to happen. It's because too much money has been spread around in every level of our society.
Okay, continue, please.
Okay. If you look at the news media, both Democrat, liberal, and conservative, you know, the liberal media doesn't exist because there's no money in liberal media.
But why is that? Of course there is. I mean, I heard, you know, a long time ago, I heard Malloy expound upon this, and then I got to see it in action for myself. Where if you take a good liberal talk host and put him behind the microphone of a blowtorch, you know, you take a conservative and a liberal and put them behind a 50K clear channel blowtorch. The liberal will blow the conservative out of the water 9 times out of 10. It happens. I mean, Malloy did it in Chicago. And you know, not by comparison, but I did it in Beckley. You know, the station that when I went there, the station numbers that I was at were minuscule. And in the year and a half I was there, we almost tripled the ratings.
Yeah,
and for that, I got canned.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But you ever seen the, and it's a Jamaican movie called The Harder They Come?
No.
Okay, but there's the album, too, the Jimmy Cliff album.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but there was a movie made to it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay, try looking it up sometime. Okay, it's a very good movie, and very profound, where the corporate record producer says, you know what, the public doesn't determine hits, I do. And it's the same thing with corporate political America. They don't determine the hits. I mean, the public doesn't determine the hits, they do. And it's not within their interest for the public to determine the hits. So they will spend kingsly sums of money to keep Rush Limbaugh on the air and have Rush Limbaugh live in his 24,000-foot square mansion and his cat. And that's all there is to it. the public doesn't determine the hits, our so-called bettors do. Regardless of whatever.
Well, and that's the absolute truth, because you can look at it, you can see it happen in a number of places. You know, obviously Malloy's not on WLS anymore, and I'm not on America's fifth smallest radio station. Even though there's example after example after example, but that also has to do with the fact that nobody knows how to sell liberal radio, and that is something that has still not been that one hasn't been doped out yet.
Well, it's not that no one doesn't know how. I just think the monetary will just isn't there. Money to be made up front, people will figure a way out. It's just their will is not there, you know.
Well, that's this is where it becomes problematic, Kevin. There is a model, and you can hear it. Any right-wing radio you listen to will have, as I've said on a million different occasions, a bunch of advertisements for various and sundry patent this or that schemes that have an 800 number at the end of the ad. Whether it's vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls, herbal erection tonics, Swedish mattresses, Bose Wave radios. And the thing is, people try to replicate that model on the liberal side of things, and I just don't think that you can make a model that appeals to authoritarian wingnuts work for people who are neither authoritarian nor wingnut, and nobody has bothered to think that through.
That's true, but you gotta understand a lot of conservative radio is like PBS. They're giving grants, and you see the advertising. That's just to fool the public, because none of that stuff sells.
But, well, I mean, no, I mean, the Bose Wave radio, there's tons. I mean, and it's a great piece.
That sells, but.
And that stupid mattress sells. And you know what? What is it? Enzyte? Apparently enough people are ordering that for them to continue buying time.
Oh, well, the thing is, it sells, but not, I say, not as much as they're just dropping millions upon millions. Not even millions, hundreds of millions. You know, hell, Rush Limbaugh's yearly paycheck alone can sponsor 50,000 of you and Mike. And you know that. For years. For a decade. 1 year of Rush's pay. So I don't care, there's not enough Insight or Swedish mattresses or Bose radios to sell to warrant Rush's salary.
No, that's true, and that's because there's a sort of a pyramid scheme going on there. Rush gets paid by Premier Radio Networks. Premier Radio Networks gets paid by advertisers, you also have to license Rush's show. For instance, the radio station where I was in Beckley, they were dead broke poor, so they said. But they were paying something on the order of $5,000 a year for the privilege of running Rush.
Yeah. So you know, the thing is, and you know what, it's almost like the banking industry too. You know, who's holding the bank? Who's the banking industry? The taxpayer. And I swear, when you get through this pyramid scheme, it's going to end up being the taxpayer. Somebody within the government is sponsoring a lot of these right-wing radio, or some individuals or something. And, you know, take it from somebody who lived in the D.C. area. Never be fooled by these so-called think tanks. They are very powerful entities within D.C. These not-for-profit organization think tanks.
Yeah.
You know, how does Pat Buchanan's magazine, which doesn't sell, but yet Pat Buchanan is a multimillionaire?
There's some magic in there that we're not, there's a curtain we're not supposed to be peeping behind.
Exactly. You know, there's a reason why we're spending billions upon billions of dollars, well, in a non-endgame endgame, which is the pursuit of global oil. It's not that we cannot, it's just that we cannot end it. It's not, because the day it ends is the day a lot of fortunes are going to be stopped and lost. And so they're postponing the ending, okay? A little bit longer, a little bit longer, so, you know, a few more interests can be taken care of. It's like 1984. It's not meant to be won or lost. It's meant to be sustained.
Well, and you know, there's some, Brian has just pointed out something by email, and he says, but Bob and caller Kevin, the corporations keep losing money on all the right wing stuff, on all the rightist radio and TV that they have supported for many years now, and lost hundreds of millions in doing so, just so that they, the corporations, can control all the major national phony news media and talk radio messages. Hence the paid off no talents like Limbaugh, Beck, Hannity, and etc. And you know what, Brian is right, but our side is not willing to lose money that way, Kevin.
Because the thing is, even the so-called liberals, first of all, there are not enough of them, and if you look down the line, even they have to depend on very powerful conservative entities for their paychecks. As much as they talk about the Hollywood elite, and you know, and they'll knock them and all that, you know, because, and they are actors and all that. Put it this way, Brad Pitt, as liberal as Brad Pitt is, he's depending on some arts conservative corporation for his paycheck. So there's only so many lines Brad Pitt can cross before it starts to affect him.
There's
for any liberal out there. It's at the end of the day, a lot of these people are going to answer to some control-fiending, money-hungry, power-hungry person.
That was true.
So even the liberals, yeah, there's money in liberal radio, but the end game, you know, the end game is control. It's like the Highlander series, you know. There can only be one.
So in that case, it becomes a matter of the one is going to be the other side. I mean, are we just done? Are we just toast?
No, we're not toast because you. I don't know. I don't know. Well, put it this way: this is why I pray every day the Chinese could rise up, really rise up, and call some of these veterans. You know, it's like, it's just, it's like MSNBC, who's owned by GE, okay? It's meant, again, like, they have right now, what's his name from Chicago? The black guy from Chicago, he's on McLaughlin Group sometime.
Caught me out, sorry.
He wears round glasses. I know.
I can see his face in my head.
His name can pop up.
Clarence Page.
Clarence. He writes for Chicago.
Yeah, he's. I can't remember. Yeah, but we got the Clarence part right.
Yeah. Anyway, he's a very liberal guy. But at the end, he's answering to some conservative. MSNBC. You know, Keith Olbermann dares not cross certain lines. And he's probably the most blatantly and highest rated show on MSNBC.
Yeah.
And he's on primetime. Think of this way, I'm pretty sure Joe Scarborough couldn't get a primetime show.
No, I don't think so.
He doesn't have the talent, and, you know, and Joe Scarborough, you know what? Joe Scarborough scares me more than Rush Limbaugh and Hannity and all that, because Joe Scarborough is a likable guy.
At least on the surface, yeah.
On the surface. He is a prick, trust me. But he's a, it's like the Ronald Reagan thing, the likable prince. You know? But I know for a fact Joe Scarborough cannot do the things that Keith Olbermann and follows Keith Olbermann up. What's her name? You know who I'm talking about.
Oh, Rachel. Rachel.
Rachel.
Maddow.
He could not do those things.
No.
So you're absolutely right. But Joe Scarborough has his morning show, and it's like, again, NBC knows how to play the public, and they have to sing, so they don't look like too much like the world's largest defense contractor, and they want to keep that image going, GE brings things to life. So they allow a few of them to slip through the cracks and give them, you know, a pretty much, how would I say, control over their show. But deep down, they're more along with the Joe Scarboroughs, because Joe Scarborough handles their day-to-day issues. You get what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I do.
Because at the bottom line, GE wants to keep on being the number one world government contractor. Because, you know what? Government money is the safest bet there is. Consumers come and go. Governments are permanent.
Very true.
Yeah. So.
And because it's transitional, the people passing through the system never really get a hand on what's being done to them.
Exactly. So to me, it's just like.
Yeah, I'm being noted. David in Tennessee says Joe Scarborough, likable prick. Yeah, that and an unindicted murderer. Yeah, he does have that going for him. Remember the name?
Who did you kill?
Lori Klausutis.
What?
Don't you remember that his beautiful young 20-something intern was found who, you know, ran 50 miles a day, was found mysteriously dead in his office?
No.
You don't know that? Oh, yeah, look up Lori Klausutis. Klausutis.
Okay. Yeah, and, well, that's what happens with a lot of, you know, beautiful Washington interns who get involved with these power-hungry bastards. You know, it's like they end up dead when they end up crossing the wrong way. And it happens on both sides of the political spectrum. But I'm telling you, and like I said, I don't mean to dishearten liberal radio. I think what's going to happen, we're going to have to end up like probably like the Terminator movies in the end. Be really underground, and thank God they haven't been able to control the net yet.
Yeah.
We may even have to end up going back to CB radio technology. 1970s internet.
Well, you know what? This is so far this is holding out as long as you know, as long as net neutrality holds out.
Exactly. And like I said, half of Russia's tech can sponsor you and Mike in every city in this country for the next 10 years. Every major market. And I know that. It's just, again, at the end of the day, it's about people control.
Well, sure it is. And from a commercial standpoint, the usual thing you get is, well, you know, we don't want to advertise on that because he generates too much controversy.
Yeah, well, you know, they're not afraid of controversy.
But you know what? Because we're in business. We want to sell to everybody. Well, that's fine. Why don't you go advertise on some right-wing asshole show, too? But advertise on this one. But some of that is really water. It's not water over the dam. It's water that hasn't reached the dam yet. Because there is no verifiable advertising model inside internet radio. And so I am at least insulated for a little while yet, by the fact that I don't have to self-censor. Because the minute that I start taking money from some advertiser, I will start self-censoring.
Exactly.
I won't do it willingly, but I will do it.
Yeah, because you got your family to feed. You know, I get that. You know, it's just, all I'm saying is, you know, even the right wing and even the powerful don't mind controversy because the game, end game is divide and conquer. It's just they want to be able to control it. It's like, I'll never forget when Joe was on the air, Cup of Joe.
Yeah.
Okay, where is he, by the way?
He's just working his butt off in Chicago, hanging on for dear life and trying to survive.
Okay. Yeah, I'll never forget what he said. One time when he was on a job, his boss purposely used to do this. There would be like four staplers on the desk and for five people, and they would want to have at least somebody fight over it.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that does go on. Petty Annie stuff, because I've witnessed it firsthand.
And you know, I mean, it's verifiable. And that's what I was saying earlier about the right wing being willing to lose money. Ostensibly, throw money away, Kevin.
Exactly.
But they understand that they're not throwing money away because they are controlling the nature of the dialogue in this country.
Yeah.
We haven't formed the liberal infrastructure that's willing to figure that out yet, because with all due respect to blogging, they think that if they throw $25 a month to a blog here and $25 a month to a blog there, that constitutes support.
Yeah.
But it's more costly than that.
Yeah. And it's just a case of, you know, it's like, yeah, there's dialogue, but it's controlled dialogue.
Right.
Okay. And so this is why I say you really got to look at a lot of this stuff. You know, I blog on this website called Multiply.
Okay.
And I'm tired on the rampage. Okay. And I wrote down four or five things that conservatives cannot stomach in this country, and it's so true. One of them is your real universal health care. Woman's right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Legalization of so-called street drugs. And gay marriage.
Yeah, not any of them. Really, I mean, from our standpoint, no-brainers, every one of them.
Exactly. And the reason being is because this is, especially the universal health care and the woman's right to choose. And when I mean universal health care, I mean it on a holistic level. That means you control what goes in and out of your body. If people have a say what goes from the ground up. And I also associate that with food production. Because a lot of times it's the food that's making us sick.
Yeah.
They need to break up a lot of these Monsantos and ABM and all this nonsense. And I think either the UN or a couple of government agencies should be in charge of food distribution throughout the world. There will be not one poor person. There will not be one person going hungry on this planet. I guarantee you that.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
Okay, because it's not about production. Because if there's money to be made, people will be growing. There wouldn't be enough land to grow. People would be using their rooftops to grow food, like how in New York we have the brownstone houses. And those are flat roofs. Those are not slanted roofs. People would be having boxes growing stuff there to sell at the local marketplace. If there was money to be made. So, you know, it's not about production. It's about distribution, but they want to control their production.
And equitable distribution.
Exactly.
That's an important word there, I think.
Exactly.
Well, Kevin, great points raised, and I kind of wish I was doing a nine-hour show tonight because I think you certainly put enough out there to fill such a show up. but we will persist because I got a bunch of blinking lights and we will do our best to further what you have started in these last 25 minutes. Thanks so much, my friend. Stay warm and take care. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
All right. Okay, brother. Bye, Kevin. Bye. Wow, that really is. There's a show's worth in what Kevin put forward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
Scarborough retire after that happened?
Yes, he did. He suddenly decided. Yeah, he suddenly decided he didn't want to be a congressman anymore.
Yeah.
And they blamed a heart anomaly. You know, she was just standing there alone in his office and keeled over dead.
Yep.
Of a bad heart.
Yep.
And she was healthy as the proverbial horse.
And there was some suspicion about the autopsy, too.
They brought in a hack who had had his license to do autopsies revoked in Missouri.
I knew it was
And was of dubious licensure in Florida.
I wanted to call about, I sent you an email about the program I saw on the History Channel.
Uh-huh.
Did you get that?
Yes, I did.
It's something to think about, isn't it? You know, we were talking last night, I believe, about what could happen as a result of the mountaintop removal.
Right.
And that is scary. You know, I asked you, did those people that were working there, were they in danger of any kind of danger, whatever? But, you know, I'm talking about the dust storms of the 30s.
Yeah, the dust, well, and what became known as the Dust Bowl when overworking of the soil resulted in massive catastrophic erosion.
Well, did you know about the man that...
No, I had never heard of it. I'm ashamed to say it, but I'd never heard of Hugh.
I'd never heard of him either, but that man was great.
Yeah, Hugh Bennett.
Yeah. And anyway, I mentioned that he was, to me, he was like the Al Gore of his day, only it was about dirt. And he knew that it was man-made. And it wasn't the people's fault.
No, but he was surrounded by a bunch of people saying, he's crazy.
Yeah, right. But the history behind that is that all that land was given out after Lincoln, you know, Lincoln gave a lot of that out for people to go out there and farm. They got a lot of acreage. And it was in the prairie. It was prairie. It had prairie grass. And the grass was what was holding the ground in.
Exactly. And by overworking it. And,
they had
and,
no grass left.
Right. And you ask in your email, Juanita, it struck me that could something as sinister as this happen to the mountains that are being abused by removal, perhaps something different but just as bad. And the fact of the matter is, Juanita, it's very prescient of you to note that because something as bad is already happening.
Something that we have.
Because what happens is if you go up on one of these hills. And you just sink, you know, those little garden spades that you use, you know, when you're putting your petunias out and stuff.
Yeah.
If you sink a spade in on one of these Appalachian mountaintops, what you will come back with is soil that is absolutely just midnight, beautiful, rich, and black. Okay. I mean, it could grow hair on a bald man. It could grow hair on a billiard
You're
ball.
You're talking about in its natural state?
In its natural state.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's kind of like Carolina.
But the problem is that these mountains, once upon a time, you've got to use a little imagination. But if you can imagine a mountain range whose mountains are actually taller than the Himalayas, higher than the Himalayas, that's what the Appalachians were. That's how old they are.
Uh-huh.
In a few hundred million years, the Appalachians, left to nature's own devices, will be flat, and the Himalayans will look like the Appalachians. Okay?
Yeah.
But, okay, so that's prelude.
Yeah.
So what you have on these Appalachian mountaintops and on these Appalachian mountainsides is this beautiful, rich soil, but it is very shallow.
Yeah.
Okay? And it is created by the constant cycling of leaf matter onto the ground, onto the forest floor. Because, you know, you have to think about the Appalachians in terms of what it is. It is the world's largest temperate rainforest.
Oh, okay.
We get abundant rain here. We have abundant water. So naturally, in the one place on Earth where water is abundant, we've let corporate America come in and poison it.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't let them. They just kind of did without asking.
Right.
So when we get all this rainfall, the soil that is on and the trees and the canopy all does a certain job to soak up that rainwater. And then that rainwater filters through the aquifers and some of it runs down the little streams in the hollers. And it creates a living hydrologic system for all intents and purposes. And a hydrologic cycle.
Uh-huh.
But when you come in with your mountaintop removal job, the first thing you do is you clear cut all the trees.
Uh-huh.
And most of them aren't even sold for timber. A lot of them are just shoved over into the valley for the valley fill.
Yeah.
And just wasted. Once you've done that, then you start with the blasting, and you blow away all the topsoil, and you blow away down to the bare rock until you get to the coal. And then when you do so-called reclamation, and understand, Juanita, I'm so glad you asked this question, something different but just as bad and just as catastrophic, when they come back to do what they call reclamation, they're supposed to return the land to what's called 80% of approximate original contour.
Yeah.
They seldom do. 80% of approximate original contour means they're supposed to return that mountain to 80% of what the mountain was.
Yeah.
But they can get variance permits for this if the landowner says, I want you to leave me some flat land.
Oh.
Because I want to build me a Walmart.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they never do. Most of it is they try to use it for pasturage and so forth. But it's just useless.
Yeah.
And what happens in the interim is that when a good rain comes, and this, again, important to keep, bear this in mind, temperate rainforest.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't, you know, you don't have to have vines and oddly painted natives to make it a rainforest.
Right. You just think of that down in South America.
This is a temperate rainforest, and it gets a lot of rain. And the mountains, as they are constituted, are able to cope with those rains. But once you've taken off all the tree cover and all the life and all the ground and all the grass and all the soil, the rain hits it and the rain runs away. And you wind up with massive 500-year floods every year. You know, a 500-year flood is the kind of flood that's only supposed to happen once every 500 years.
Yeah.
But we get 200- and 500-year floods in southern West Virginia now every year or every other year.
Yeah.
And it always happens wherever the ongoing mountaintop removal operation is, because there's nothing to keep and retain the water. There's nothing to slow the water. There's nothing to absorb the water.
Wow.
And so you've just sort of shown your analytic skills.
Well, you know, and the thing about that, this guy kept telling, you know, something was going to happen that, what did I say his name was? What did you say?
Bennett?
Yeah, Bennett.
Hugh Bennett?
Yeah. And he was in Congress. I think he was a senator. And he finally, to start off with, the farmers started getting dry spells, and it started getting to be a, what do you call it when it doesn't rain, a drought?
Drought, yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, when Hoover was in, they asked for help, and he just felt like they could work it out among themselves.
Well, let the free market take care of it. And that's what I was talking about earlier this evening, talking about the short scope of human life and the narrowed ability of the human being within a given lifespan to understand the totality of what's gone before and extrapolate into the future from the past. The free market miracle has been proposed in America before, and it failed just as horribly, and it wound up in the Great Depression,
definitely.
Just like, you know, well, worse and better at the same time than
yeah,
what we're in now.
Yeah, wanting to go back before we had Medicare and all, you know. Yeah,
well, yeah.
That's the way it used to be.
Ah, good old.
I sent you a bill.
Yeah, my friends, it was the good old days of American stick-to-itiveness and pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps.
Yeah. But what to me, what was interesting was this guy kept filing, and when Roosevelt came in, he wanted to do that, and this guy they kept voting it down or whatever, whatever they did in the Congress. You know, this life would have been anything. Because they just couldn't see it, and that this guy was an expert on soil. He knew what he was talking about, and he knew that something worse than the actual dust storms were going to happen. That you know something big was going to happen, and as it worked out, this thing started roaring up, and I wrote down the measurements of it. This they called it a black blizzard.
Yes.
And it was, they call it Black Sunday in, I think, 1935. And it was, I never wrote it down. I can't read it. It was 20,000 feet high, 1,000 miles wide. And he was up, this Bennett was up in the Congress speaking, and they kept letting him know it's coming, it's coming, it's coming, because it was going to, you know, 1,000 miles wide. That's pretty wide. And it was going to Washington, D.C. And it finally came, and they looked out, and somebody said, well, it looks like it's going to rain. And then somebody said, no, maybe we're going to have some kind of dust storm. And then he said, then there it was. And it was black. And they said, oh, but now we know what you're talking about. But there was a native.
Yeah, and that's when, you know, just like the Bible, and that is when they cry, Lord, Lord.
Yeah. And like, he had the original kind of grass planted and also, showed them how to, do their ruts, you know, in the fields and all.
Right.
And
see, that's another thing that happens here in Appalachia, Juanita, and I'm not trying to cut you off. You
uh-huh.
mentioned the grasses and that just, for the most part, the coal companies.
Not native.
Yeah.
Not native, right?
Right.
Yeah.
For the
I remember you talking about that.
For the most part, they have planted non-native invasive species grasses, that operate contrary to anything that an Appalachian, biofield is.
Yeah.
But they plant it because it grows quickly.
Well, this, and then also, Roosevelt, he got his stuff into it, and he had them plant I call it a fortress of trees, you know, rows of trees to help the soil stay in. Because what it was topsoil was caused this dust storm. And it was just, you can imagine something that big, Bob?
No, I can't.
No, and they said there was 6 tons of dirt per U.S. citizen at that time. Blown.
Amazing.
And anyway, I was thinking about, you know, all the different people that nobody wanted to listen to. And isn't that the way it is all throughout creation as we know it? Nobody wants to listen to people who are trying to help people. And just like now, you know, they want to say, oh, there's no such thing as global warming. Well, the audacity of people and to listen to somebody that doesn't know anything or doesn't, or has their hidden agenda.
Oh, you know what, Juanita? I want you to do something for me.
What's that?
If you want to see right before your very eyes the living embodiment of what you're talking about, where people take facts and oh they got a hidden agenda and just denying reality, after the program, you go to wvgazette.com, okay, and then on the main page, let me just type it up here, make sure it's still there.
WV, as in, like, West Virginia?
Yeah, WVGazette.com. And I'm looking at it here because I want you to have the story, because there's the Cold Tattoo blog on the one hand, and Ken Ward does a good job of keeping that civil and orderly. But on the main page news stories, it's absolutely, I don't know, it's like a trip to the monkey house where the chimpanzees are in full blossom flinging poo. Under the heading Top Stories, if you will click Study, Mining Damage Pervasive and Irreversible, then just go down and start reading the comments.
Okay.
And you will see, in all its glory, people engaged in the absolute denial of the reality before their very faces.
Oh, I don't know. This is so strange that I've been thinking about this so much lately, and comparing, you know, different things with the mountaintop removal. And when I saw this, because this was the first thing, they've got other things on there. If anybody's interested in this, it will blow your mind to watch these, what the dust storms were. Well, oh my God, they were horrible. And this one thing was really amazingly bad. And, I mean, just unbelievable. And these things can happen to us again. And it's kind of like old Noah when he was building the ark. They laughed at him.
Yeah. And
I hear my phone beeping.
Yeah, I think your phone's about to die, Juanita.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I am sending you the link to that story right now, so you won't have to go fishing around for it.
Up here. I haven't found the story yet.
Well, I just sent you the link directly to it, and
good.
I put it in the chat room for others to read as well.
I'm fading fast, I think.
I think so. Just shoot me a note and tell me what you think.
Okay, I will.
Take care, Juanita. Happy weekend.
You too. Night-night.
Bye-bye. And let's make this, let's keep rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, you know I had to call in before we closed out the evening.
You'll get the last word tonight, David.
Well, that's good. I did want to give people the quote of the week. I think this is the ultimate quote of the week. Paul Mooney was asked about Tiger Woods and what his fatal mistake was, and without missing a beat, people, he said, "He didn't kill the white women. White women do not talk if they're dead."
One more time, please, because that...
He said about Tiger Woods, he said, Tiger Woods, was, the mistake was he didn't kill the white women. And he said, that's dead white women do not talk. He was referring to O.J. Simpson day.
Oh.
But the way he
that's cold.
Was so fun. I know. The way he said it was so funny, though. And then he said he made a really observant point. He said why Tiger Woods was having so many affairs with that woman. He said, well, I think it was because he was on steroids, and it increased his sex drive, and he had to have sex with that many women.
Yeah, but if you're on steroids, doesn't that dry them up to the point they're like raisins?
I know, but see, what people don't realize is that's a myth. It happens. It's not a myth. It's a half truth because it happens to older men, but younger men it has a different effect.
Oh, it. Well, I mean, if you're sitting, if you're roided up and you're taking and you're taking testosterone, you know, testosterone will work for just about anybody.
Right.
But that's also incredibly dangerous and deleterious.
Right, but the story I did call about, did you talk about, I haven't been listening a few times this week, did you talk about John Farron yet?
No, I did not.
Mary Farron tried to deliver divorce papers to her husband, John Farron, the former deputy White House counsel to President George W. Bush, but hubby didn't want a divorce, and he urged his wife to reconsider. She was afraid of his temper and refused. Now, this is where it gets horrific, people.
Yeah.
So Farron tackled her in a bedroom at their New Canaan, Connecticut home, and ripped out a clump of her hair. Then he beat her with a metal flashlight until Mary lost consciousness. When she woke up, he was still pounding away.
Yeah, and this is the traditional family values crowd.
Yeah, this is the traditional family values.
Yeah, and let's reiterate that. This is the former deputy counsel. That means the lawyer under the main lawyer to George W. Bush.
Right.
Strangling and trying to murder his wife. Now, I'm glad you brought that up, David, because while we have to work quickly, it bears noting.
Yeah.
That there is, you remember Sally Kearns, the creepy woman in who's in the legislature in Oklahoma that wants to protect traditional marriage. She's the one who said that she's the one who said that gay people are worse than terrorists. I mean, Peter dinged her pretty good a couple of years back, but you know she's always good for a quote because she's insane. She's a right winger of the worst kind. And she is in the upcoming, if it's not already started, upcoming legislative session of the Oklahoma legislature. She is introducing legislation that would, get this, forbid the usage of irreconcilable differences as grounds for divorce if there are children in the marriage, if the marriage is more than 10 years old, and there's a couple of other stipulations. So in other words, a good family values, marriage, traditional marriage protecting right winger in Oklahoma wants to see more of what John Michael Farron allegedly did to his wife who simply wanted a divorce. And again, he knocked her down, he tried to choke her to death, and then tried to beat her to death with a metal flashlight. I'm guessing a mag light, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm guessing a mag light too. And it is interesting. She's in her hospital bed and the update says that she fears for her life and she hopes he doesn't get bail. His bail is set at $2 million. Let's hope he doesn't get bail. And with that...
No, so there will be bail. Somebody will bail him out.
Well, he's on suicide watch now, so I'm not going to say what...
Well, take the watch off.
Yeah. Take the watch off and beat him with it. That's what I say.
Well, no, I mean, just eliminate the suicide watch and give him back his belt and shoelaces.
Well, there you go. All right, Bob.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Hey, David, thanks. Have a great weekend.
No problem.
Bye now. That's our correspondent, David, calling from Maine. I'm glad he brought up the John Farron. Can you imagine that? I mean, here's a guy who has literally operated feet from the presidency, from the president himself, and in a fit of macho rage, because he don't want no divorce. And you know why he doesn't want the divorce? It's not because he's madly in love with his wife. It's because he's madly in love with his money. And he does not want to give up that money in the course of a property distribution settlement in the divorce. So instead, it would be easier to strangle and beat her out of the notion of getting a divorce. What? But, you know, it's just another day in traditional family values Republican America. What? The little woman wants a divorce? Strangle and beat that notion out of her airy little head. Wow. I want to thank folks who have stepped up to try to help us keep the cash flow coming. It's ever so important to keep this going. And just a reminder to folks that we've still got a few copies of For the Love of Apple, For the Love of West Virginia, the beautiful, beautiful handmade print by our dear friend Diane, for as little as a contribution of $75. It can be yours. Art is important, and this is a keeper. So thanks to everybody who contributes in every way that you do. Thanks to the moderators in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Susan and Gene. Thanks to Texas Betsy, our blogger, who sends so many great stories my way. Thanks to John Fox, Peter Godbold, Ben Birch, ELO, otherwise known as Sue. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. The hardest working, bravest people I know. And always, always, always... Gina, it's all for you.
There's a lot of bad blood underneath the veneer. Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome aboard. It's a minute past the hour here in the hills and hollers of almost level West Bicod, Virginia. And we have come to the end of the first full week of 2010. And seeing as how it is the end of the first full week of 2010, well, that has a sort of independent reality around here, as do eventually every day here will have its own little theme, but this theme has been extant for quite some time, frankly. This is Friday on the Front Porch. Now, granted, Friday's on the front porch. Fridays on the front porch are much more enjoyable in the spring and summer of the year. But it can be pretty nice this time of year, too, as long as we have things that can keep us warm during the course of our ongoing conversation. And, of course, Friday on the Front Porch is an opportunity sort of to clear the decks, as it were, of the stuff that has been in the stack for the better part of the week that we haven't gotten to, and there are indeed a bunch of those. We've got leftovers. Maybe it's leftover Friday when you get right down to it. We've got leftovers from Wednesday prayer meeting, and we've got leftovers from the other days as well when we just didn't get to stuff that needed getting to. So we're going to hit all of those if possible. And yes, I did just I did just pop in midstream there. That's because I missed a button. But we're here, and it's live, and it's real. It really, really is real. So jump right in. It is Friday. Everything is, it's open season on anything that you want to bring to the table. I'll get us started. I'll get us started just by remembering somebody. It was a couple of days ago that I saw this posted to Nick Regalado's Facebook page. You know Nick, the Coalfield Kingsnake. And I didn't want to let the weekend without noting the passing of this individual, because something goes along with him or leaves this earth with him, and I'm talking about the passing of Tsutomu Yamaguchi, who was 93 years old when he passed away. At 93, he had finally succumbed to stomach cancer. And he occupied a rather special place on the planet. He was the only human being who was a recognized survivor of both the first use of a nuclear weapon against a civilian population, that being the atomic blast leveled the city of Hiroshima, and the second attack on a civilian population using an atomic weapon, that being the U.S. bombing that leveled Nagasaki. The first thing you can say is that's some horrible luck. The second thing you can say is that in a way it is a blessing to all of us that there was such an individual. It was a strange series of events somewhat that led to Mr. Yamaguchi's presence at both sites. He had he was a resident of Nagasaki, but he had gone to visit Hiroshima from Nagasaki, and he had he was in Hiroshima when the United States used an atomic device for the first time in the history of the Earth, and did so against a civilian population. He said that he, when the blast hit Hiroshima, he felt like a leaf on the wind and was picked up and carried on a cushion of air and rushing dust. He suffered serious burns, but as soon as he was able to travel, he returned home to Nagasaki. He was in the stairwell of an office building when that blast struck. If you want to hear more, I commend you to NPR.org and a blog called The Two-Way. The headline is, Japan's only known survivor of both atomic blasts has died. And he died from stomach cancer. And I don't wish to use, quote-unquote, Mr. Yamaguchi's passing as an extended metaphor for anything, but I suppose that's what I'm doing, and I apologize in advance. But this is a man who lived to be 93 years old after being caught up in...